The Joe Rogan Experience.
Train by day, Joe Rogan podcast by night, all day.
Powerful Tito Ortiz, ladies and gentlemen. Right when Alienware keeps trying to get me to upgrade. Bitch, I ain't upgrading.
Update your software?
Alien Respawn. Oh. This thing keeps coming.
We should just wipe all that.
Maybe not supposed to when they're starting helping us out. Dude, first of all, thanks for doing the podcast, man. I appreciate you having me on it, man.
It's cool. I think the fans dig it, too. So
yeah, I'm wearing
social media.
Punishment community. Athletics since what, 99? Is that when you started company?
1999.
You're goddamn businessman, athlete. Is that the focus now? Now that you're completely done fighting?
My clothing company's always been my focus. It's been my love. You know, I have love for something that I've never wanted to get rid of. People who try to come in and buy me out, and I never wanted to sell out, you know?
Right, because it represents something. Your baby. You made it.
Yeah, and it's punishment. I mean, every person who goes through work deals with some type of punishment. You know, either you wake up at 5 in the morning and you press that alarm clock going, God, what am I doing this for? Well, you come to realize you got to pay bills. You got to take care of your family. It's punishment. And that's what all life and walks of life go through is punishment. That's what my brand represents.
You told me something once. We were talking about submissions. And you said, you know, the problem with submitting a guy is you can submit the guy, and after he taps, he's okay. And he's like, oh, man, he got lucky. Man, he got lucky. But when I get on top of you and punch you in the fucking head for 15 minutes.
I'm punishing
until
your
the
ass.
Referee pulls me up. That is punishment. And I'll never forget that, because that really that one quote really embodied your career, you know? Yeah. I mean, you only submitted Yuki Kondo and Ryan Bader. Those are the only two guys, right?
That's it. In MMA, that's it. That's all I've ever done. I always wanted to put on a show, man. You know, I thought it was, you know, those guys are going, oh, he caught me, got lucky with the arm triangle or with the arm bar. I mean, don't get me wrong. I would love to submit at Machida. That would have been awesome. But I've always wanted to be dominating, be on top and just pulverize a guy and just try to finish them and, you know, make him not want to fight me again.
The Yuki Kondo one was the all-elusive one-arm guillotine.
That's actually called a Cobra Choke.
Cobra Choke?
That's from Cal State Bakersfield.
Is it a one-arm?
One-arm.
Are you grabbing his chin?
What I'm doing is I'm hooking the chin. Right. And I try to pin his chin across to his shoulder, and it's almost like a throat choke. And Cal State Bakersfield, the coach, Daryl Pope, showed us that choke, and we'd choke guys unconscious in wrestling matches. And the referees don't know what's happening, because in college you're allowed to turn the chin wherever you want. In high school rules, you're not allowed to turn the chin wherever you want. But I learned that, and I do it to a lot of jiu-jitsu guys, because they'd pull guard. They go, oh, you got my chin under my arm, I'm fine. But once you hook and kind of snuggle in, guys don't go anywhere.
So it's like one of those old school catch wrestling moves.
Exactly.
Is that the same one that Jake Shield used on Nick Thompson? In Strikeforce, he hit him with some sort of a one-arm one, and he posted out with his left arm, and then he arched his back. It was pretty gnarly.
Yeah, it's a little different, because this one, you got to hook literally the outside hip. You need to hook the outside hip to make it happen. And you hook the hip, and what you do is you're compressing the lungs and compressing the chin and the neck at the same time. So it's like a compression choke.
Is it the hardest thing to me, seems, as an observer watching it, seems it's hard for dudes to put new aspects to their game once they become successful. That seems to be the most hard.
But I think that the hardest thing is doing it in repetition, because everything you got to do in repetition. To get better and better, you have to do it in repetition over and over again. Guys think, well, okay, I know that move. I don't need to do that anymore. No, you'll lose it during going live. Because in wrestling that I learned was I would do it so much that it was reaction. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a factor of just doing it to do it. You did it as reaction. And so when I would go for a high crotch, guy would defend that. Then I'd go to a single. Guy defend that. I'd go to a double. Guy defend that. Then I'd go back to a high crotch.
And you're not even thinking. You're just chaining them together, because that's how you drilled it.
Chain wrestling, exactly. Yeah. And that's what it came in fighting, the same thing. But you kind of get caught up into the idea of going, okay, well, I'm going to do the submission defenses. That was my first thing. I didn't want to learn submissions because I wanted all the defenses first. And when I learned all the defenses, I was like, okay, I'm not going to get caught anymore. Then I started learning offenses. Then after I started learning offenses, okay, great. Now I got those positions good. Then I started learning more stand-up. And then it was kind of like I didn't want to overstep my boundaries by doing too much at once. So I just kind of put in a little, I guess, you know, like little schedules. So it was like, all right, this week I'll work on this. The next week I'll work on this. And then I had to go back to the first week a couple months later. So it's like,
yeah, it's hard to absorb something new also, especially if you're trying to do like two different things new, because when you absorb something new, it becomes like an obsession where you're like thinking about it background.
You'll go for that move over and over and over and over and over and over again. I mean, when I was in high school, I mean, I was known for a head and arm and a low single. I mean, that was, people go, you tie up with him, he's going to head and arm throw you. you stand away from him, he's a little single you. And I was known for that. But then when I got it to be a junior and senior in high school, Paul Herrera was my coach who fought in the UFC. He goes, Tito, you're going to live by that. You're going to die by that. Let's learn high crotch. Let's learn double leg. Let's learn snap down. And I started learning these different things in collegiate wrestling that I was like, oh, I'm starting to learn all this different stuff. So I wasn't just stuck to one thing.
Yeah, it's funny when you see a guy like Cody McKenzie, you know, who's right. got this fucking ridiculous guillotine that nobody can run away from. But it's so weird to have one move like that.
But someone will learn the defense to
yeah.
it. I mean, you look at, who was it? Guy from Strikeforce, from Pride, who came over here, the heavyweight.
Noguera?
The big guy who just got burnt for
fighting. John Olive Einemann?
God, I'm going to think of his
he
name.
He got burnt for?
Steroids.
Carwin? Bubba? No, Carwin was never a Pride guy.
No.
Overeem?
Overeem. He had a sick amount of guillotines. He caught Belfort with him over and over and over, and all of a sudden he got away from it.
He pretty much got away from the ground game, period. Yeah. When he became K-1 Grand Prix champion. And just to clarify, he didn't really get popped for steroids. He got popped for elevated testosterone to epitestosterone ratio.
You're which a fighter was from, has steroids. It don't matter.
Yeah, it's from testosterone. Okay. I mean, he admitted they shot him with testosterone. He was really trying to concentrate entirely on the kickboxing for a while. You know, when you see a guy that, I mean, he's one of the best examples ever of a guy whose career was in the shitter and then pulled out of it, and all of a sudden he's on top of the world.
And amazing, dude. He's great. I mean, Anderson Silva. Look at Anderson Silva. He was in Pride, and he was losing and getting submitted, and all of a sudden he
Rio
came over.
Rio Chonin, Takasi submitted him. Yeah.
And he came over to UFC and just hasn't been beat it since, I don't think.
Yeah, it's interesting when you see guys, when you catch guys like in between camps and, you know, there's a split in the camp. That's when you really realize like how important it is to have the whole fucking package together. Yep. To have a coach that you will listen to have trainers who are looking out for you, to have a guy who's actually analyzing your training and say, you know, he looks like he's peaking a little early. We got to take him back a little. Let's check his heart rate. Guys who are really looking at you like a racehorse. And when a guy doesn't have that, like Anderson Silva went for a stretch in Pride where he'd left Hujamar and he formed Muay Thai Dream Team and he sort of on his own for a little bit too. And he was losing, man. He just wasn't the same dude. Just wasn't the same guy.
And then he surrounded himself with great people, man. He does an awesome job. But, I mean, it goes down to the fighter also, man. We go through a lot mentally. It's just the battles that we go through in our own heads. And you got to have that confidence, man. That confidence is what changes everything.
What is it like when, you know, you go from, I mean, I was there. I was very fortunate to be there for your very first fight in 1997, was it? Wes Albritton?
Yes.
Is that what the dude's name
Wes
was?
Wes Albritton from Alabama.
Yeah, you came in as a replacement, right?
Yeah. I watched Jerry Bolander fight. And we wrestled in high school. He went to Livermore High. I went to Huntington. And we're at the state meet, and I beat him. And then I watched him win the lightweight, at the time was lightweight, under 199, the lightweight tournament. And I was like, that kid looks familiar. I remembered. I was like, I called Tank at that time. I was training with Tank. And, dude, I want to fight in the UFC. I could crush these guys. I see Bolander just smitten guys and just pretty much handing their ass to him. And he goes, you think you could do this? Like, yeah. He goes, all right, we'll see about getting you a fight. I get a call like 2 weeks later. It says UFC 13.
How much training did you have, MMA training, before that fight?
Probably about 2 months.
What did you do during that time?
I wrestled. I knew how to street fight. I grew up in the 80s. We were punk rock era. We used to slam dance, and if there was no guns, people didn't have guns. Real men fought. You know, we fought, and I got in fist fights. Got my ass beat a bunch of times. My brother Marty and Jim and Mike and their brothers or their friends. But I just came from a wrestling background. I knew how to street fight. I mean, I knew how to fight.
So that's how you looked at it. You looked at it. Look, I got
this
my wrestling.
This is a fight. I got my wrestling. I'm going to take this guy down. I'm going to beat his head. And I knew at the time, I was a state champ. I was very confident, and I knew that guys couldn't stop my double. These guys weren't college wrestlers, and I knew I would dominate.
What is it like to – there's got to be completely different mindsets from the first time you step into the octagon to as your career is progressing to becoming a champion. You know, there's got to be a lot of differences in the way you approach things.
Like, I just really didn't think too much about it. You know, I didn't want to get lost. In
the beginning, was it like all of a sudden, this is what I'm doing?
All of a sudden, boom, I was like, I'm trying this out. And all of a sudden, I was like, wow. I remember stepping in the cage and going, holy shit, what am I doing here? What's going on? And people listening right now going, you're Tito Ortiz. No, I was an average guy to me. It was like, okay, don't make a mistake. Keep your hands up because at the time...
Well, everybody's an average guy. That's the secret at the end of the day, right? Yeah, everybody's just a person.
Everybody's just a person. I mean, I'm just a person. I just work really, really hard. You know, Paul Herrera, who fought in UFC, David versus Goliath, he was my high school wrestling coach. And I was training with him at the time, and I remember him saying, and this was a sign of cockiness. He's like, oh, what is Gary Goodrich going to do? Arm wrestling to the ground?
Oof.
And then I was like... Yeah, I wouldn't think of it that way. I would look and see what he really does. And I started watching, seeing some of the other Kapkido or some of the fighting he did. And
That was one of the scariest KOs ever.
I was there in it, and it shook my heart. I was like, blam, he got blasted. And I was just like, holy shit. I remember at the time, my girlfriend, Kristen, she was like, I don't want you to happen. What happened to Paul happened to you. I'm going to train hard. I can be too confident. I'm just going to go in. I'm going to know I'm going to fight. I'm going to fight as hard as I possibly can. And I did. I worked my butt off. You know, I'd run 4 miles a day, 6 days a week. I would wrestle 3 hours a day with jiu-jitsu, 2 hours a day. I know I would do my boxing. I didn't do kickboxing at the time. I just did boxing. I didn't spar that much because, I mean, at the time, I didn't really understand what sparring was about. You know, we did a lot of wrestling. We did a lot of ground fighting stuff. We did stuff.
But he didn't do much stand-up fighting.
Yeah, not really. Not really. I mean, Tank was the guy who I'd have to spar with, and I didn't want to get punched in the face by him. Everybody saw what he did to guys. I never got a chance to spar with him. But I'd wrestle with him all the time. We'd do submission wrestling all the time, and I was a lot faster. But it was just one of those things that as it progressed, when I first started to, like, when I went to Cal State Bakersfield after I fought my first time, I took a year off. I went to Cal State Bakersfield to try to finish up to get my, you know, my teaching degree and get my major in physical education, my minor in special education teaching. And then me and the coach didn't see eye to eye, and I was like, wow, man, this is something that I don't want to do. I got an opportunity to go back and fight for the UFC, and I was like, all right, I'm going to kill this coach at Golden Arrow at Cal State Bakersfield, or I'm going to leave. So I packed my stuff up, dropped my stuff off at his school and said, you know what, you're a piece of shit, and I don't see how anybody respects you. I'm either going to kick your ass or I'm out of here. So I packed my stuff in U-Haul, moved back down to Huntington, got a job at Spanky's adult bookstore, and
They were one of your first sponsors.
Yeah, one of my first sponsors.
Spanky's on your shorts.
Yeah, Spanky's XXX, my first sponsor. It was an adult novelty store. I worked there. I sold merchandise. I was probably one of the highest-selling guys there. I was a great salesman. there are some interesting stories that would happen there. But beyond that, you know, I started training. I got my first fight back.
So it was like an opportunity in the middle of a place. It was the best door for you.
It was.
The best opening.
It was. He actually, the owner from the company, knew that I fought. And he goes, there's a UFC in Brazil. And I told him I wanted to go. He said, how about I pay for your air ticket and your hotel to go out there? Me and one of my other friends, we went out there, and I made my first little fighter cards, and I had my phone number on it, had my email address on it, I had a picture of me with my back to the picture, it said Tito Ortiz on it. I remember walking up to John Peretti and going, I want to fight. I'll kick any of these guys' ass. I'll kick that Frank Shamrock's guy's ass. I'll kick his ass. I'll kick his ass. I go, I want to fight. He looked at me like, who in the hell are you? I go, I'm Tito Ortiz. I go, watch UFC 13. I go, I almost beat Guy Metzger in the finals. I got beat up guy Wes Albrecht. And at the time, I was a young kid. I was cocky. And
how old were you?
I was 22. I just turned 20. Yeah, I just turned 22. I was a young kid. And I mean, at the time, I was hungry, man.
You can't judge a man on what the fuck comes out of his mouth when he's 22.
Believe me, at that time, I didn't care. I was the toughest guy in the world, I thought.
Well, you did not have a good childhood.
No, I came from nothing. I mean, I think God has put me in the right ways, a lot of things, you know. Don't get me wrong, I don't go to church all the time, you know. I just believe in being a good person. You know, you treat people how you're going to be treated. You know, I never try to step on anybody to get ahead.
That seems to be self-evident, right? I mean, pretty much everybody who has a brain knows, treat people well and good things happen to you. There's an ethic to the world, right?
Yeah, I mean, when I was a kid, you know, I mean, I had a problem. I used to steal a lot when I was a kid because I never had anything. My parents are drug addicts. You know, we lived in motels. We lived in cars. We lived in people's garages. And everybody else always had something. And I never had anything. My parents could never buy me anything. So, you know, I would steal to put clothes on my back. I'd steal to put food in my mouth. you know.
So that was always your reality growing up? Your parents were drug addicts your entire time of your childhood?
I was about 6 years old to about 13. It was.
So that was just your reality. That's all you remember.
I go to therapy right now. It's like I'm talking to my therapist, and it's like, and I realize the things that I do and why I do them. It's like, okay, this is the reason why I do that. This is the reason why I do that.
Yeah.
But it's a learning process, and I think each person as us individuals, we got to understand ourselves. And how we're brought up is usually is how we become, but you still have that opportunity to make those decisions.
Yeah, you have the opportunity to change your behavior, but you have to look at it, and it's hard to do. It's hard to look at yourself.
It's challenging to look in the mirror and to question yourself.
Mm-hmm.
People could say, "Oh, that guy's talking shit about me." No, maybe that person's speaking the truth about you. You're just too in denial to really realize it. And I'm still learning. I'm human. I'm still learning, and I look at those things as it's a challenge. It's a challenge from God. You know, I could be a quitter. I could be a complete drug addict right now and be strung out on heroin as my parents were, or I could be in prison right now and doing a life term for killing somebody for something, or I could be dead. I could have been shot as one of my friends were when I grew up in Santa Ana, but I was able to make a choice of my future. And I think that through my UFC career, people had a kind of a bad image of me because of the bad boy image, but I was just trying to sell. I was just trying to do what Ali did. You know, I was trying to do what some of the bad guys were that got the most attention. You know, at Tyson's heyday, he had said some of the most negative things ever, and people loved him, and that's why he was selling, you know, 1.5 million pay-per-views. I mean,
yeah,
I've done that. I've done that for the UFC. And
there is a part of it that is show business that people kind of have to understand. It's like rappers. Do you think they're really going out shooting people?
No.
Yeah.
You know, black.
Some of them from Atlanta. You never know, though.
Some of them get a little caught up in the game.
Yeah.
But, you know.
But I think you got to find that happy medium, you know, where you realize that it's about yourself to make the decisions. It's not about others who made you make those decisions.
How did you get out of the place where you were, growing up with drug addict parents? How did you get out of that? Like, what was your mindset like when you were separating from your parents and becoming your own person with that sort of a background?
Well, my mom gave me $800 when I was 18. I graduated. She goes, "It's time for me to be a man." And I wanted to move out too, but she was like, "Here, time for you to be a man." I moved in with my brother Marty and his wife Christine. I was doing drugs. I mean, crystal. We smoked weed. We drank in the weekends. But I worked at an Allied Moving Service, and I would work 16-hour days, drugged out. Kind of forgot about wrestling a little bit. It was about a year after high school. I was at some club, and I was partying. One of my old coaches pulled up to me. He's like, "Tito, is that you?" "Yeah." He goes, "You doing all right, man?" "I'm fine." I'm looking at myself. "What do you mean, I'm fine?" "Cause you don't look so good, man." I go, "No, I'm cool, man. I'm good. "Cause you ever thought about coming back and wrestling, going back to school?" I was like, "Yeah, but I don't know. I live on my own. I'm just trying to make ends meet." And he's like, "You know what? I tell you what I'll do. You come to my office, and we'll see about getting you financial aid." I go, "What do you need financial aid?" He goes, "You're Mexican, right?" I go, "Yeah." He goes, "We can get you financial aid. It'll pay for your schooling, pay for your books, and possibly give you some type of stipend to pay for your house or apartment." I go, "Really?" So that was a Saturday night. I was partying. I was at Rhino Room in Huntington Beach. I was drinking. We partied that night. Sunday rolled around. I was up still doing drugs, doing crystal. That night, I looked in the mirror, and I didn't recognize myself. I was 182 pounds, 183 pounds, 6'2", sucked up. I mean, people see me when I make weight at 205, my size now, it's the big difference. But weighing 185 pounds, pimples all over my face, I look like a drug addict, and it scared me. I looked at myself and I said, "You're turning into your parents, Tito." And I have these conversations with myself all the time, just to do a reality check, to check myself. And I woke up that Monday morning, I called Allied Movement Service and I said, "I can't come in today." They're like, "What do you mean you can't come in today? You can't call and say you're not coming in today?" I go, I got to check out the school thing." "No, you don't come in today, you're fired." I go, "Well, I guess I quit then." Walked in that office, and the coach had a big smile on his face. I remember Raul Doherty at Golden West College had a big smile on his face, and he was like, "Showed up. I want to give this a try."
That's amazing. So this is just based on your wrestling ability that he saw from high school. He said, "This kid's got some talent, and let me give you an opportunity to get out of your situation." He knew you were in a bad spot.
Yeah, I mean, I knew I was in a bad spot too. I just wasn't.
Isn't that one of the best things about competitive athletics? Just yeah. that you know that you can't get an opportunity like that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't think you can only just in athletics. I think it's in general in life. There's always someone that gives somebody an opportunity, and I think people got to take that advantage and take that as a situation of maybe it's God giving you a chance, maybe it's someone just looking out for you. I mean, I've done that through my whole career. If I try to help guys come up and. You know, I look at it, it was a gift. It was a gift to me, and it was a challenge. It was a challenge from God saying, you want to become a real person?
How hard is it to kick that crystal?
That was almost 4 months, 3 months.
Four months to kick it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, my situation was when I would drink, I would like to party. That was it. I wasn't like I had to do it to get up and go. I hated the feeling the next day, the burnout feeling. I hated that. That sucked. But what it was I didn't feel normal anymore. I didn't feel that I was able to cope on a normal feeling.
So you just wanted an escape.
I wanted an escape. It was from, it's funny because I talked to my therapist. I wanted to get away from that child of always wanting the attention that my parents never gave me. And that was, it was weird because I was, the only way to push that stuff away where I didn't think about it anymore was doing drugs. It helped me deal with it. I dealt with it. I dealt with it well. And all of a sudden, when the drugs weren't around, then I had something else to deal with it. School. School kept my mind off of it. Wrestling kept my mind off it. The security that I had from my coaches and from the time my girlfriend, Kristen, who backed me, I felt great from it. You know, I felt great from wrestling. I felt great from winning tournaments. I felt great from winning a match. I felt great when I ran 4 miles, when I lifted weights, when I would drill, when there was no one else in the room and I'd be drilling by myself, or I'd have one of my other guys with me and I'd be drilling by myself. The coach would be looking at me going, all right, our training's done. I'm like, no, I still got some work to do. And I always wanted to be better. I always wanted to do something better. And I think that's what it was just hard work and dedication. And yeah, I mean, here's another story that, I mean, I look back and when I used to drugs, I mean, when I was growing up, when I was with gangs and stuff, we used to sniff rubber cement. And when you hallucinate and so forth, when I was growing up, I would hallucinate that I was walking on a red carpet. And this is at the age of 12 years old, 12, 13. I would hallucinate that I'm on a red carpet and people are taking pictures going, Tito, this way, pictures, pictures, pictures. At that age, not even assuming anything that I was going to be who I am today as a
fighter. Well, who you are today is probably because of that very hunger. I mean, it's the exact opposite of what your life was. You weren't treated as special at all, so you wanted to be uber special. You wanted to be...
But it was weird. I look at it and it was like, maybe was that God showing me that this is what could happen?
That it could be possible?
That it could be possible?
Well, you know, it could be. But, I mean, I think everybody's motivation when you're in a bad situation is to improve. And it's one of the weird paradoxes of life, especially as a father. Because I want to do the best I can for my kids and provide them with the most love and give them the most experiences. Everything. But everybody I know that's interesting had a fucked up life.
Right?
It's kind of weird.
I mean, look at everybody who's very, very successful. Yeah. They have had a fucked up life. And they don't want to be in that position. They don't want to put their family in that position. And I've worked so hard to make sure that doesn't happen for my surroundings now.
Yeah. You
know, I look at it and yes, I have nice cars. Yes, I have a nice house. And yes, I'm very financially comfortable. But my biggest thing is making sure my kids have nothing to worry about, where they don't have to steal to eat.
And I'm not convinced that your situation or my situation is bad for children. As long as they get enough attention, you communicate with them, I do think that they can see life for what it is.
But you got to give them challenges. You have to give them challenges. You have to make sure that they're working hard for what they're getting. Mm-hmm. If you just give them everything they want and they say, well, my dad's going to get it for me. Well, my dad's going to get it for me.
Exactly.
No. My son, Jacob, who's with me right now, actually... he has all A's in school right now. He's in private school. Has all A's. He reads on a sixth grade level now. He's in the second grade.
That's awesome.
And our deal is Jacob, I'll buy you anything you want, but you got to get all A's in school. And you got to do four things for me. You got to respect your mom. You got to respect your students. You got to respect your teacher. And you have to respect me. And he goes, done deal, Dad. I promise you. And he's a great kid. And he has a good head on his shoulders.
Well, that's amazing. You know, you're really lucky. And
I'm very lucky.
And not even that. It's also just the attitude and the fact that he gets to see how hard work pays off. You know, I think that's so important. to, you know, to see, like, I mean, he's seen you struggle. He's seen you up and down, you know. He's seen you win and lose. He's been a part of the whole thing and seen the actual pain and the effort that's involved in becoming excellent.
Yeah, let me tell you, when I fought Rashad last year, it was the worst call I've ever had with him ever. And I was like, Jacob, did you watch the fight? He goes, no, Dad, I can't watch the fight. And I go, what do you mean? He's like, it hurts when I watch you lose. And I was like, oh, it made me start crying. I was like, what do you mean? He's like, I can't watch you lose. Like, you get hurt and it scares me. I just can't handle. I can't handle the pressure. I was like, okay, now I know it's starting to get him. I was like, wow, this is starting to get me right now. And then I realized, okay, I got a couple more fights left, and I got to worry about it. And when I told him my last fight was in July, and he was like, thank God, Dad, now we can spend time together. And that's how much time I'm away from when I'm training. You know, people understand that. You know, I it's not like I get in a cage and I fight. No, I'm putting in 3 months of work.
In Big Bear,
3 times a year. That's 9 months out of the year. I mean, that's a long time you're away from the family.
And by the way, if anybody wants to buy Tito Ortiz's Big Bear house, that shit's for sale, right?
Yeah, that's for sale. I'm trying to sell it. I'm trying to get rid of it.
It's pretty fucking badass. I saw some photos of it online. Pull them up, Brian.
It's 5 stars you can get.
We'll try to get that motherfucker sold. Yeah, I bet there's some fans out there that probably don't even know that that's your training camp and used to be Oscar De La Hoya's training camp.
De La Hoya made it for himself. You know, it started with one home, and then he made another home right next to it. It's on an acre and a half of land, and he made it right next to him. And it was 4,000 square feet, 4,500 square feet. Got its own jacuzzi in the room. Everything's set on the inside. I mean, it's got its arcade system. I mean, it's a man house for sure.
It's dope. It's all wood too. It's all logs. It's made with logs.
It's pimp. It's about as pimp as you get. I mean, I go
it's
there.
It's pimp and it's rural.
Yeah.
It's like woodsy pimp.
It's almost like better than my house at home. I'm like, Jesus.
But is that it?
Yeah, that's it.
Oh, well, come on, dude. Look at that place. Yeah, that's fucking badass.
But you got to understand, when I first went to Big Bear when it was 2001, I stayed in a 2-bedroom apartment with 8 dudes.
Dude, this is so
that's
sick.
That's the room.
What happens if your kid gets straight A's, though, and wants to buy this house? Or that's what he wants you to buy?
Well, you never know. I mean,
might keep it.
No, our job is, you know, I mean, as a father, is making sure that he gets through school, you know. And he says he wants to be a fighter, but I tell him what's our deal. And our deal is to make sure that he gets his master's degree first. If he gets his master's degree, he'll be buying this house for me. I already just ended up getting it. I've already paid for it by then.
Go Google it, folks.
Yeah.
It's on YouTube.
So what I was trying to get at when I was asking about the psychology of the difference between when you first were like, fuck it, let's give this a shot, to when you actually have something to lose. Now, like this conversation that you had with your kid where he doesn't want you to fight anymore. You know, he's like, I can't watch. I don't want to watch you lose. Like,
it came down, I think, the Couture fight. It was... I defended my world title at the time 5 consecutive times, and I was up in Big Bear for 3 months. Whole time, 3 months. I never left the mountain. I didn't do any PR. I sat up there, and I busted my ass. And I thought I was prepared. I may have overtrained myself a little bit. That was the first problem I had with my back. You know, I came down. I got injections in my back. I didn't want to pull out. I was like, I ain't pulling.
What did it feel like?
It felt like someone stabbed me right above my tailbone.
So did it feel like it was in the spine itself?
It was in the spine. It was like, it felt like right, like literally right on the spinal cord. So what happened was a bulged disc. The disc got bulged and it pressed on my spinal cord, and my legs went completely numb.
Oh.
And it was the worst. I mean, it was a month before the fight, Couture, and it was the worst pain ever. And people don't understand. I mean, and I get all the time, people make, Tito makes excuses and da-da-da-da. People, man, if you guys ever had back pain before... try to train on it. Try to run on it.
Not
try
only
to
that,
on
when
it.
Someone says it's an excuse, really, it's true.
Yeah.
You know, you could say it's an excuse, but if you want to have all the information about a guy's performance, you really got to know, first of all, what goes wrong in training. How many different dudes go into the cage fucked up already?
Yeah,
I mean, how many? So many times when you see guys, you don't even know they might have something wrong with their shoulder, they might have something wrong with their hip. You know, you never know. And you know, to people get upset at you bringing that up, you've gone through knee surgeries, back surgery.
I have an ACL replacement. I fought 6 months later after it. I had back surgery, two-level fusion, my lower back, L4-5-S1 fused. I fought a year later after
that. Now, when they fuse it, is it like they did with Nate Quarry, where it's like a flexible piece of something in between, like a plastic?
No, they fuse. They put screws in it. I have
also, they bolt them together, and they make it like one disc. It becomes like one, two becomes one, right?
Two becomes one. And
does that change your movement?
No, it didn't change my movement. I could touch my toe. My hands can touch the bottom of the ground when my feet flat. Not a problem at all. You know, it was a hard recovery. Very, very hard recovery. That was the worst pain I ever had in my life. I've had ACL surgery, like I said. I had my neck fused, C6, C7 fused. I had meniscus, 50% meniscus.
And when you had that fused, is it the same way?
Same exact thing. A Dr. William Smith out of Las Vegas who did my surgery, who's the best surgeon in the world. And I'll say that again. Dr. William Smith is the best surgeon in the world. I was able to bounce back and fight. I was able to bounce back and train. I was able now not to have back pain anymore. I mean, it was so bad where when my Escalade, I actually was leaning so much on my right ass that when I got my back fixed, my seat was still leaning. And I would sit normal. It was dented. And I would sit normal, and I was like, what the fuck? Man, Jesus, that is just weird. And just little small things. I mean, getting up to go to the bathroom, sitting down to go to the bathroom was impossible.
And it's the same thing in your lower back as it was your neck? They're both fused. So was it the same kind of pain?
It was different pain. In the one in my butt, or excuse me, in my back would go down to my butt, would go down to my legs. My legs would go numb. The one that was in my neck would go through my whole body. It was going down my arms. And this is before I fought Forrest in UFC, UFC 106, where I had a ruptured disc. The disc was ruptured. And I still fought. I had no choice. I mean, you gotta pay bills, right? But they went in and they fused it. They took the disc out completely. They stuck in two bolts and a plate, and they screwed.
By the way, Brian, that video's online.
Yes,
Tito Ortiz surgery. You gotta see it because
people don't understand. You gotta watch this because you'll see this guy's putting in the screws in my neck.
He's hammering in his neck like his neck is a chair.
Yeah, and like putting in these bolts, and you hear.
Yeah, it's like he's
screwing on the bolts.
It's like he's hammering a leg in on a wooden chair. Yeah. Dunk, dunk. Tito Ortiz surgery, maybe? Surgery video? Yeah. Neck surgery?
Yeah, neck surgery. It was gnarly. But, you know, it's challenges, man. God gives me challenges. You know, I could, you know, as everyone calls me or tries to call me a pussy for making excuses, I could have been a pussy and pulled out of my whole career. And I wasn't letting it happen.
Listen, the people that call you a pussy are silly. You can't address them. They're silly. It's, look, there's so many. Is that the video? Oh, yeah. Oh, you don't even want to watch this. Look, that's the spacer. Yeah. That thing that guy's screwing, that's to open the neck up. How gnarly this is.
No, that's me on the ground. And I had him record it just so people understood what they're going through.
This is so fucking crazy, man.
So right now he's clipping out the disc.
God, this is nuts.
And you guys
look how fucking wide your neck is open.
Yep, and you'll see the little tube.
This guy's in there with a hammer pulling shit out.
See the blood on the tube right there? Yeah. Sucking through the pipe, and that's all the disc.
Oh, my God.
So he's pulling the disc out.
Oh, my God.
And he's like, now he's just pulling little disc pieces out completely.
He's pulling chunks out.
Yep. So he's, the work they do now is just amazing. I mean, like I said, this Dr. William Smith and this God has given him some blessed hands.
It's like your car, your head is a car.
No, literally, it's like doing, you're servicing a car that has a broken blown transmission.
That motherfucker was straining as he was pulling shit out of there.
I just wait until you see the
part. Oh, here's the hammer part. Watch this.
He's hammering in the bolts. And,
Jesus.
And then the raddest thing is, too, is when he screws them in, like, right? See, right now he just screwed in the first little tip of the screws. And then he goes with his whole hand, he goes right here. And now he's tightening it down.
Oh, my God.
And then, like, if people go online, you check us out in the audio for this. I mean, it is ridiculous.
You can hear the squeaking?
Yeah.
Oh, let's hear the squeaking.
And he'll start tapping it, like, tap, tap, tap.
Oh, Jesus fucking Christ.
And then we hear him, like, it's like he's changing a tire, but it's actually changing a neck.
Oh, look at this spacer, this fucking giant hunk of metal they're sticking inside
you. No, dude. After I got this done and I watched this, I was like, it made me cringe. I'm like, are you fucking joking right now?
Oh.
3 millimeter punch.
Like the Terminator. Were you watching this like while you were healing up?
Yeah. Hell yeah, I was laying in bed. It was actually, I got it done. It was my boy's second birthday, Jesse and Journey's second birthday, and they're having the party downstairs, and I was up in bed laying down. We're talking about just like, man, I wish I'd be downstairs with my family, but you know, sacrifices we do to become fighters.
You
huh?
couldn't even move around. Like, how long were you in bed for?
I was in bed for a week.
A whole week.
But no, right after surgery, I got up. I got up. I had a neck brace on. I got up. I stood up. I walked to my car. I sat down. My friend Juan drove me back to Huntington Beach from
Holy
Vegas.
Holy shit. You drove? Like, you were in a car?
I was in a car.
And you feel like your head would be like a Weeble.
I was in my Phantom. I mean, it's a
bobblehead?
It's a little different. You're in a Phantom.
Yeah.
But the raddest thing is I had this during the shooting The Ultimate Fighter. So they shot The Ultimate Fighter, and I was getting kicked off. I got kicked off because I had to get neck surgery. And back then, The Ultimate Fighter was shot 6 weeks before. Dana goes, you can't be seen in public. I was like, what do you mean I can't be seen in public? He goes, you got to wait until we show that you get kicked off before you can be seen in public. Are you serious? He goes, yeah, if you're being seen in public, they're going to know you're going to have to get neck surgery. I'm all, okay. He goes, so I had to stay in the house for an extra month and a half.
And hide?
Yeah, literally hide. I would go to my physical therapy. I had to pull through the back door. And I would be like, all right, no one's looking. All right, go. Because at the time, paparazzi would be looking around and stuff. So I was like,
that's
all right.
Hilarious.
And go. I would run, make a run to the door, and I'd get in. And everybody was all hush-hush when I was there. And it was like, it was the worst. I mean, not be able to go out was hard because I had a neck brace on, and I couldn't take my neck brace off for 7 weeks. So it was
how tough. Long was it after surgery before you could actually train?
It was probably about 2.5 months, 3 months, where I was able to do a little bit of cardio stuff.
That's it.
Yeah, I was able to hit the bag a little bit.
So for 2 months, nothing, no movement at all. Nothing.
Well, a little. I mean, you know, physical therapy. You know, at Joe Donahue down in Costa Mesa, called Pro Sport. We did a lot of physical therapy stuff where I was doing a lot of movement, some shoulder workout stuff, a little arm paddling, biking.
But all very low key.
Very low key. You know, and the way my doctor put it, he's like, Tito, you got to understand, all those nerve endings are starting to heal up again. For the first three or four weeks, you got to chill. You got to let those things just heal. So, I mean, I was eating painkillers like no thing. I mean, I was like just handfuls of them. But he says, you don't want to feel any pain. He goes, when you feel pain, it gives irritation to the area that's trying to be healed. And it's not going to heal that fast. So I was like, all right, I'm never going
to
feel it then.
So he's telling you to take as many painkillers?
Yeah. He says,
sounds like a dude who's selling painkillers.
Right. No, but I mean, you got to put it to acknowledge, it's not the factor of selling painkillers. I mean, he's not making money off the painkillers. He's making...
I'm totally kidding.
Yeah, no, but I'm just... Yeah. Listeners don't understand that.
Right. So it's important, actually, to take those pills.
Take those pills. Doctors say take them. When it's time to get off of them, stop taking them.
How hard is that, though?
It takes a week. It's hard. You know, you go through the little shakes and, you know, the sick feeling like you have the flu.
How ridiculous is it that shit is legal?
Yeah,
there's got to be another way to fucking stop pain than that.
Dude, yeah, rubber cement.
Well, it's crazy because, you know, people, they'll take painkillers and they try to get off them and they're in pain. And they're like, I got to take painkillers to get rid of the pain. No, it's because your body's addicted to those things.
I know so many fucking people that have had problems with pain pills.
Yeah, I know a lot of people. I mean, there's a lot of kids that are in school that get them from their parents. And they're
snorting them. Oh, yeah, a lot of kids are smoking them and snorting them.
Fucking snorting Adderall.
So
that's ridiculous.
Yeah, a lot of that. Yeah. Ridiculous. It's bizarre. It's
weird. We were growing up. I mean, kids, while we were smoking weed. Yeah. I mean, maybe the rich kids had cocaine. I mean, that was it, man.
I've seen so many people that were normal people, and then they had a back injury or something. They got on pain pills, and they could not fucking get off.
Well, that's what started my dad. He had a hernia. He had a hernia, and he had surgery, and he started taking painkillers. And my uncle. Because the doctor said, we can't prescribe painkillers anymore. Well, I was still in pain. So my uncle hooked him up with tricepsis heroin.
Oh.
Bam. All of a sudden, everything, life changed from that point on. Because my dad, he's still in a business. I mean, when I was young, I mean, I remember when I was 5, my dad had his own carpentry business, and he did well. I mean, we lived a great life, I thought. I mean, at the time. But, I mean, when I was 6 years old, everything changed. I mean, I remember perfectly. Everything changed so fast. All of a sudden, we're in a house. We're hearing my parents fighting all the time. All of a sudden, we're in a house. We're in someone's garage. And then we're in someone's trailer. And we're in a car for a while. Then we're in motels. And it was challenging. And I'm very thankful for my mom leaving my dad because I got a second chance in life, I think.
Do you feel like you could have ever been the guy you were if you didn't have such a shit childhood?
No. No way.
There's no way you would have that drive, right?
That's, I wouldn't have the same drive, no way.
You'd be, but you'd still you'd still be a winner, though, right?
Yeah, but you know what?
You'd figure something out.
I would, you know, I may be a little bit better in school, you know. If I got a different opportunity, I think if I would have got the same opportunity I've given my son of being a straight-A student, I think I mean, my parents were very artistic. My dad was an artist. My dad was a carpenter. My mother's an artist. I think I have great brains. I mean, shit, look at where I am right now. I mean, the business work I've done already, by all the damage I've done to my brain when I was younger, I'm on great capacity of just learning experience. And I think that my kids have that same opportunity now, but without the drugs around.
Well, you certainly got out of MMA, too, without incurring some, like, speech problems or any of the shit that we're starting to see now from guys.
I see some of the guys now, it just, like, makes me cringe. I'm just like, God, man. All those times, all those fights, and you think of guys, you're like, God, I just want you to see you guys stand up and just punch each other in the face. And I was like, okay, I look at boxers.
Yeah.
I mean, for perfect example, actually one of my buddies who back in the day, who used to box, Fernando Vargas. And
I know Fernando.
Has he changed?
A lot.
A lot.
A lot.
And I mean, I love him. I mean, he's my boy.
He's a great guy.
Awesome guy, stand-up dude, cool cat.
But there's no doubt he paid a price.
He paid a price, man. I mean, these guys, I mean, they get in their heads.
And it's weird when you know a guy before he pays the price, and then you see the results. Yeah. And then you go, this is real.
The Trinidad fight was the one that changed everything.
I met Terry Norris once in Vegas. I didn't actually meet him. I was standing next to him, I should say, while he was talking to a fan. And he was, you know, someone's asking him, you know, what's going on with you? Are you going to fight again? And he was talking, and it was almost like it was a joke. I was like, is he drunk? Like, what's going on? And then I realized, oh Jesus, this is why you haven't seen him in years. He's fucking punch drunk.
Yeah, it's just from taking so many blows. And like, saying, is it exciting to put a great fight on? Yes, but to stand there and slug with guys.
Well, it's all, not just that. There's, it's also the gym wars. You know,
that's 100% you're true.
And I mean, he got hit too. Terry Norris got hit by guys like Mugabe. Right. You know, when Mugabe was a monster, when he was KOing everybody, he KO'd Terry Norris. It was ugly. Or did Terry? Who did Terry Norris KO? That was like a vicious KO puncher. I'm pretty sure Mugabe KO'd Norris, though. I don't want to say that.
Yeah, I mean, you look at some of the guys now. I mean, guys that Tyson's fought. I mean, they're not all there, man.
Yeah.
I mean, you see a lot of these guys go through some things. I mean, football players and other guys that have the concussion.
Oh, Terry Norris KO'd Mugabe. Jesus Christ, Joe Rogan.
I know, Joe. Come on, dude. Joe.
It was Julian Jackson? Who the fuck was it that Mugabe like knocked out where it was really ugly? Oh, I don't remember. Look, Terry Norris had gotten stopped a bunch of times in his career. And, you know, the fights that where he got stopped, it wasn't even that just that damage that really did it to him. I think it was Julian Jackson knocked out Terry Norris. There was really the gym wars, right? The gym wars are the things that people don't see, but they accumulate. And a lot of times, it might as well be a fucking fight. There's, I mean, I've been in gyms where watching dudes who are high-level guys.
We're fighting. I mean, Rampage. Me and Rampage were training partners.
Yeah.
We would spar. We would fight. Yeah. We would kick each other's asses. We would fight. I mean, it was just that type of thing where we got the best of each other. And it was like, all right, cool.
Good job. I mean, some guys can handle that, but some guys are not that durable. No, and you slowly see it slipping away on them, and you know exactly what's causing it.
I mean, my biggest thing was, my trainers would be like, okay, we're sparring 3 times a week. I was like, whoa. What are we sparring so much for? And they're like, well, you don't want to spar? I go, no, I just want to get my ass whipped every day. I go, let's do twice a week. All right, we'll do twice a week. But don't get me wrong, there was times, I mean, years and years and years that we'd do 3 times a week. I mean, sometimes 4 times a week, but I mean, I don't like to get hit. Me a guy who likes to get hit, I'm gonna show you a stupid man.
Yeah. Well, I think that it's a weird aspect of MMA. You know, the guys who just want to stand there and bang. I'm like, man, you don't know what you're saying. Like, you're saying something crazy. Like, you got a ticket, okay? And there's only so many places you can punch a hole in that ticket. and you're just going to give up all these tickets on purpose. That's crazy.
Just to put on a show? Cool. Yeah. Fans love you. Awesome. Great. But when it's time to cash in that check?
Yeah.
Are you sure you can count those numbers on there?
Well, it's like, I love the fights between Arturo Gatti and Mickey Ward. They were fucking amazing fights.
Amazing.
But if you know anything about brain damage and you know anything about what causes it, those are the type of fights that those guys are going to pay for.
Yeah,
pull up a video, Julian Jackson KO Terry Norris. Yeah, Julian Jackson versus Terry Norris. This is the fight that I was talking about. It was frightening.
Really?
You know, yeah, well, Julian Jackson was another murderous puncher.
You're knocking guys out and they're blowing snot bubbles.
Yeah.
Your brain ain't working all the way there.
Yeah.
At all.
And that's not good.
You're like waking going, hello, hello. They're like, mama, dad, no, we're not at home.
It seems like the guys with the grappling-based styles that are trying to initiate grappling more avoid a lot more damage than the guys who are striking only.
Damage. I mean, if you could put on a show, I mean, I have done a great job in my career of being the dominant person on top.
Yeah, well, not only that, I mean, look at a guy like Anderson Silva. He barely gets hit, and everybody loves watching him fight. You don't have to slug it out with people.
It's true. It's very true.
You know, and, you know, people like watching submissions, too. It's people like watching a guy figure out how to beat a killer.
Yeah, and in MMA, you never know.
Yeah, you never know.
But people can't figure out how to beat Anderson yet.
Not yet.
Which has been very impressive.
Maybe
very,
John very Jones great. Would. You know,
what's the catch weight there?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't think you should be one.
You think 205?
I don't think John Jones can get any lower than 205 without and be healthy.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, that was
That's
it.
Terry Norris getting killed. Watch this shit. Ratio. Julian Jackson was ridiculous.
Oh.
Julian Jackson was one of the most murderous power punchers of all time.
See, stuff like that just kills someone, man.
Yeah.
And you realize how there's only four boxers in the year dying. Stuff like this is what does it.
The fucking power that guy had.
Right hook. Ooh, another right hook. Oh. Jesus.
Yeah, poor Terry took a few of those in his career.
Man.
I watched him fight Dana Rosenblatt. It was like one of his last fights. Dana was a friend of mine from Boston. And Dana beat him by decision. But I remember watching Terry in a fight. I'm like, he can't pull the trigger. His body's just... He couldn't pull the trigger.
Yeah, that's one of the things, too, that I talked to Jason Perlo about. Because Jason, you know, he's worked with some great guys. I mean, and he goes, you can tell when a guy loses it. Because when he hits pads, when he spars, it's not there.
Yeah.
You just lose your timing. You lose everything. I mean, for what they say, what Jason told me, he says, first goes your legs, then your body, then your mind.
Yeah.
I mean, you see it. I mean, all fighters do that. I mean, thank God my legs are gone. Thank God my body's gone because my head's still here. So now it's time to use my head instead of my body and my damn legs anymore.
I remember on my brief time of kickboxing, there was moments where I would lay in bed at night and I have fucking headaches. And I'd be sitting there when my head is throbbing going, what the fuck am I doing to my head right now? Like, what is did you ever wonder where are you at? Like, what's the tally? What do you owe? You know what I mean?
No, you know, I always felt like I was smoking weed after I sparred.
Just like dizzy, just silly?
Dizzy, silly feeling.
Just, yeah, people say some silly shit after they spar. Like, like sometimes the funniest conversations you get in with guys who just got done sparring and then they go eat.
Yeah, and it's like, double. Like,
everybody's like,
you're
almost like hammered.
Yeah, no, seriously. Yeah. That's what they call a punch drunk, I guess.
Yeah. Well, no, sort of, but that's a different feeling. That's like a sort of post-workout, post-getting punched in the head feeling.
Your adrenaline's rushing. You got cracked with some good shots. You kind of get that iron taste in your mouth. Or like
blood. Yeah, the copper.
Yeah, that doesn't taste
do
good.
You, did you ever, like, think, like, how many times can I fight? How many? Did you ever, like, try to, like, sit down and look at it and say, realistically, how much damage? Because we all know there's certain guys, like even boxers, that got out in time, and you listen to them talk, and they're fine.
Yeah.
You know, they have no problems at all.
Well, that was my thing. I never wanted to take too much abuse, you know? I mean, I think Liddell's the only one that's really hurt me. Literally. I mean, Wanderlei Silva hit me with one punch in our title fight when we fought. That made me feel like the world went upside down. Chuck caught me, you know, in our first fight with two good shots, a good right hand, a good left hook. And it just feels like your legs get dropped. Your legs come out from under you.
It's they
like,
stop oh, working.
Stop working. Just everything goes bing. I mean, I've never been out unconscious ever in my career. You know, I think Rampage and when we were sparring made me see some twinkle bells where everything felt like it's been there. Like, well, this has been here before. Wait a second. I've not been here before. Move.
Right.
But, I mean, I've never been unconscious where I'm on the ground and wake up going, oh, what happened? Thank God.
That's some scary shit.
Yeah, that's some scary shit. You know, I've been able to get up right after, like, boom. You know, like I said, first time me and Chuck fought, I popped right on my feet. I was fine. And then the judge tried to keep me down. I was like, get the fuck away from me. Let me stand on my feet. Get away from me. You know, a little embarrassed, but at the same time, it's just one of those things as fighters and as men, you don't want to be in that position.
Yeah, you don't want to. But you still didn't want to accept losing, too. It's like,
I mean, losing.
Even though it just happened.
Yeah, I mean, people understand, I mean, as a fighter, I mean, at heart, as a fighter, when I lose, it's like a loved one dying. That's how much pain it is. Just like, it sucks. Everything. Fighting is so lonely, and people don't understand it unless you're a fighter. The loneliest feeling there is in the world is laying in bed before a fight and going, you have to go out there and fight. You got to put on a show. You got to make it fun for the fans to watch. And everything lies on you. There's no one that could save you. There's no one that could boost you. There's no one that could help you throw punches. There's no one that could help you take a guy down. It's only you by yourself. And there could be your family, wives, girlfriends, brothers, sisters, dads, mothers, going, good luck, kick some ass. That's as far as it goes, right there. Goes no further than that. You're the one that got to get in the gym and train every day. You're the one that got to push yourself in sparring, do the extra drilling, do all these extra things. And, you know, I never really understood it until I started working with Jason Perlow, and he explained it to me. He goes, man, isn't this a lonely sport? And I was like, fuck, I never heard of it that way. But yes, it is, man.
It's lonely, but it all comes back into that one gigantic moment of the exact opposite of lonely when you win.
Yeah, when you win. Everybody wants to be your best friend. Everybody wants to be a part of the joy. And
not only that, the moment that you actually win. Like, yeah. When you tap Ryan Bader, let me tell you something, man. Yeah. That was about as happy as I've ever seen you. Because you had gone through a drought for a few years, and it's like you wanted that W. Yeah. And when you tagged him, you dropped him, and you grabbed a hold of that neck and pulled guard and fucking crushed it. Oh. And he tapped. Dude, you were so happy. You jumped up.
That was like watching Discovery Channel and you see a lion chasing a gazelle and trying to eat for the first time of his life.
Mm-hmm.
I was that lion.
Just finally got it.
Fucking finally got it. I remember locking my hands and I was working with producer Radum at the time. And I remember just hooking the guillotine, wrapping one leg over, wrapping the other leg over. I remember just thinking, producer goes, keep your elbow down, Tito. Whenever you get the guillotine, keep your elbow down. I kept my elbow down, and I just squeezed everything together. And it wasn't the fact of pulling his head towards me or my body towards me. It was just doing a crunch and just crunching everything together.
Just
and
smushing it all.
And just squeezing the shit out of it. I remember, I'm not letting go until the referee rips me off because I'm not going through something where he didn't tap or whatever.
Right.
The referee has to rip me off. And I remember... And three days before that, I did the Ultimate Fighter with Michael Bisping. And all the guys are on his show. They're like, Tito, man, please do the Gravedigger. Please do the Gravedigger. Show us how you do it. I was like, nope. I got to wait until this weekend. Because when I drop Bader, I'm going to drop him. I'm going to beat him. I'm going to do something. Whatever I do. But when I get it done, I'll do the Gravedigger for
it's
you guys.
It's crazy that was only the second submission in your career. It really is crazy. Because I always tell people you have a very underrated ground game. When you pulled that triangle off on Machida, I was like, oh, shit. Yeah, like, that was a wrinkle that a lot – look, there's a lot of dominant dudes, top dominant especially, that don't have that wrinkle in their game. Yeah, they don't have that aspect of the game. You locked that thing up fucking sweet. Nice. And if it wasn't Machida, if it wasn't a real Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt, you would have had that shit.
I would have.
You went for a tumble with it. You went for the arm, too.
And that was my mess up. You know, when we drill, I drill the triangle. Then from the triangle, I go for arm bar because the guy pulls away. And I blew it by doing that. I probably should have never did that. I should have stayed at the triangle the whole time. And all the times I ever catch guys now in triangles, I just make sure I hold on to it and don't let go. And I know now to grab onto my shin. Don't let anything else go. Just grab your shin. Just hold on and wait the guy out.
And for you, too, gable grip around the back of the head. Pull the neck.
You pull the neck.
It can't handle it. No, after a certain point in time, you have to
There's
tap.
A guy from Brazil that I moved out here who teaches at my school at Punishment Training Center, Ricardo Abreu, and we go over that stuff. He's like, Tito, I promise.
Oh, Cyborg.
That guy? No, Ricardo Abreu.
He's
3-0 right now. He's an 85-pounder. He's an up-and-coming kid. He's 26 years old. And he's amazing. Amazing.
Who's that? So the other's Abreu. Cyborg Abreu. You know what I'm talking about? Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu guy?
Yeah, I think he might be.
I think it's the same last name.
Yeah, no. Same last name. But this kid, he's an up-and-comer. He's 3-0. He's amazing. Try to get him to fight on the next Strikeforce card. But he still got the good former fights until his UFC status, I think. He just needs to build his confidence a little bit. But it's just one of those things, like I say, man, you get those submissions and you do it over and over again. You're used to just making sure you don't make the same mistakes twice. And my whole life, I've never done that. You know, I try to make the same mistakes more than once.
There's so few guys that are big guys that have a strong guard. You know, yeah. For every Fabricio Werdum, there's, 100 guys, the turtles, when you put them on their back. Yeah. It's just...
And when I went to Abu Dhabi was when I started learning, you know. I started realizing, I mean, I was a wrestler. I mean, I'm going to my back, it took me a good 2 years.
Just to be comfortable?
To be okay to go to my back and be right. Okay with it. But it was one of those things that when I sort of started fighting, I wasn't going to my back. Guys weren't taking me down. No way. I was defending. But then you get a little lazy when you start doing jiu-jitsu. You start going, oh, okay, I'll pull guard. I teach my guys now, don't pull guard. That's the last thing you guys can do.
What do you do guard. If you can't take a guy down, though, and the guy's fucking you up kickboxing? Then pull guard.
You better be fucking tougher in both those things. you pull guard because you're going to like pull guard. He's going to smash you on top.
Well, there's guys who you can't do that to. Like, yeah. Look at that Paul Sass guy. You watch that kid out of Great Britain?
Not yet, no.
Woo! His triangles are nasty.
Really?
I think he's got 8 or 9 wins by triangle. Wow. And he just catches everybody. He just caught Jacob Volkman with a triangle. Yeah. But, I mean, you get in that motherfucker's guard, you're in quicksand.
Well,
you
so know? If someone fights him, give me an opportunity and I'll show you a defense for a triangle that... Everybody, you can get out.
I just love watching the guy. Oh, yeah? Yeah? Really?
It's you can get, I mean, someone can lock a triangle on you and you're going to get out.
Is that that sort of roll where you roll towards where the foot is locked up?
All I do is I put right hand goes on top of the shin, left hand comes on top of that, and I do a tripod, right, put the knee down, and literally his legs will open up. He has no choice to get it.
I want to see you try that on Fabricio Werdum.
It works.
Really? Yeah, it'll work on Fabricio?
It really works on Fabricio.
All right, I got to see that, man. Yeah, no, I got to see.
It's amazing, dude. It's good. Good shit.
What's the matter? The mic isn't on him?
Yeah.
That's a good shirt for you, Brian.
It's dangerous. Down.
Punisher. Dangerous.
Dangerous.
How much, when you were in the middle of training for fights and then, you know, the fight would be over, how much time would you spend, like, working on your skills? We just constantly making sure you're always in shape? Like, did you have a set thing that you did?
Well, I would take a month off.
Always?
Always take a month off.
Just let everything heal up.
Enjoy myself. It was, because I was, when I started wrestling in high school, that was my deal. I would go through a whole season of wrestling. Summer would start. And right before summer first started, we'd have freestyle wrestling. And during freestyle, you know, for the first month, I would work really hard. And then as soon as that was over, I'd have a month and a half to chill before school started. So I was like, all right, I get to party, I get to drink, have fun with my friends. And then as soon as school started again, wrestling started. So I couldn't drink. I had to stick to school. I had to get a good grade. So I would do that. So I followed right into college. When I got into college, I did the same thing. When I got into fighting, I did the same thing. As soon as the fight was over, I'd have a party with my friends and for the first month. And as soon as that month was over, okay, there's my date. I'd have a contract signed for another fight, and I'd start training.
Did you feel more pressure once you became the champ?
Yes.
That's felt when, like the walls were closing in? That's when all the contenders were running at you?
I would yeah, it came down to that. But I always wanted to learn. I was always going out to learn. You know, I'd go out to John Lewis's. I go out and work with all different guys all the time. I wanted to learn. I mean, that's be one thing I could say to guys who are listening, who are fighters, is don't ever stop learning. Don't ever think just because you're with one school that you can't go with other guys and learn. Because when your coach says you can't do that, that coach's not right for you. You know, because if you're not learning enough in your gym, you're only as good as the guys you're with. You got to go out and you learn from other guys.
It's hard to learn new shit and try it on fights.
Yes.
Right? Because you're worried about doing something where you're not like. You're double, you're ground and pound, that shit's in your head. It's cement, right? It's not going anywhere.
I get a guy against a fence, I'm taking him down.
Right, but you jump in an arm bar on somebody, it's like, fuck, should I really be doing this?
Yeah. Am I going to give up one position for another position right now? No, I probably shouldn't do that. But it was just one of those things, you know, I got set in my own ways, you know, I got comfortable. You know, the guys I trained with, I would bring guys around me, and I started Team Punishment. We first started, it was... No, Rico Rodriguez, Rampage, myself, Liddell, Tiki, Rob, Fabiano Iha, John Lewis. I mean, there were so many guys.
There's a name from the past, Fabiano Iha.
Fabiano Iha, right? The guy turned out to be a scumbag, too. It was just one of those things, man, that you just kind of look at, that you just try to bring the best guys around you. And when I didn't have the best guys around me anymore, I was like, all right, well, I'll just get the guys that I need that I thought I needed at the time, you know.
Did you run all your camps? Did you have a head trainer ever? Did you ever always allow...
always had a head trainer. Always had a head trainer. A guy who always told us what we needed to do. I always did that. I mean, there was a couple times that I had to do things myself just because of my injuries. You know, after the Couture fight, there were so many injuries that came back to back that we were always guiding around things to make the right things happen.
Well, it's also got to be very hard for you to develop any sort of a real relationship with a head trainer, because you really were a part of the whole transitionary phase of mixed martial arts even being recognized as a sport. Yeah. I mean, in 97 when you first did it, it was I was there, man. We were in the fucking middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
And it was a weird half-full gymnasium. And so to get a professional, like, real head coach, yeah, like, it's almost like you got to train them.
Yeah.
It's like,
well, there was
many guys were there?
There was two really good guys. I mean, it was funny because back in the day, there was a kickboxer trainer that I would use, you know, John Spencer. There was a ground guy that I would use, John Lober. And I would do the wrestling, you know. I came from college wrestling, so my wrestling, we just drilled. We drill all the time. And then as I got a little bit better, right before I fought my world title, I trained with Colin Oyama, who was a kickboxing trainer. And I would have Fabian Iha, we'd do our jiu-jitsu. Rico Rodriguez, do our jiu-jitsu. Rampage and sparring with us all the time. So we had great sparring, great wrestling, some of the guys in the college and so forth. And then about when I fought, Vitor Belfort. Me and Colin didn't get along. There was some things back and forth due to Rampage. Rampage was in his ear saying shit and saying, oh, you could beat Tito. And it was never about that. Me and Rampage were always good friends. And it just got too personal between me and Colin. So Saul Solis came about because of Rico Rodriguez.
Great trainer.
He was one of the guys who pretty much invented the MMA training game. He was the first guy to do it. And the other guys caught on to it is when we did the Ultimate Fighter. That's when people caught on to it, when I can't have him come in and do the Ultimate Fighter in Season 3.
Then that was a great time for you too, man, because people really got to see how much attention and how much focus you put on coaching kids.
Yeah.
This is such a direct contrast. My friend Tate was on that season.
All right,
Tate Fletcher.
Yeah,
he was,
yeah.
And unfortunately, he was on Ken Shamrock's team.
Yeah.
And he was like, Ken Shamrock, like, barely fucking paid attention to them, he said.
You know, I mean, I came from a wrestling background. I mean, if any collegiate wrestlers are out there, you know, you guys got coaches. Wrestling's a family. You know, it's a family. It's not just about coming in and training. It's, you know, you're okay with your girlfriend. You know, you're okay with your friends. You're okay with your family. That was my family. My family was wrestling. That's what saved me, was wrestling, you know. Wrestling saves lives. You know?
So you were bringing everybody together. Like.
Yeah, everything was always a family deal, you know. And with Saul Solis, like I say, he doesn't get as much credit as he does, as he should, I think, because he was one of the first guys to kind of start the MMA training game, I think, behind all of it. I mean, when I had the Ultimate Fighter, he's seen all the stuff we did. He did half the stuff, you know. I just had the mentality to have the positive outlooks on things that I would say to the guys, to get them going, to get them pushing forward, to push harder in practice. And it wasn't like, you guys better show, or you guys are pussies and you guys ain't going to be a part of this. And no, it was like, what do we need to do to make you guys better? What do we need to do to make this better? What can I be on a positive influence to you guys to make you guys love to be here? And they did. You know, you look at Kendall Grove, you look at Michael Bisping, Hamill. I mean, these guys that came up from my team, they understood it. You know, Bisping now, I mean, he's a huge star. He understood it. I mean, there's a couple of times I pulled Bisping around. I go, be the asshole, dude. People hate you. They're talking about you, right?
I think it annoys him, though.
They talk about him. He's getting paid.
Definitely.
And people got to understand that. Yeah, people, you know, I couldn't hear it enough where Dana said, stop talking to fucking about money. And I'm paying for my family. I'm paying for my kids. This is a business to me. From day one, this
Dana
is...
Dana tells you to stop talking about money?
Yeah, he always says that. He says, you need to stop talking about money. Fans want to hear that. And if I hear fans saying that, oh, Tito's talking about fucking money again. What do you guys do for a living? You know, you guys get in the cage fighting. You guys get in the gym training. You guys get away from your family 3 months at a time.
If Floyd Mayweather wasn't talking about money, I would think there's something wrong with him. Like, yeah, check his temperature.
Yeah,
dude, right, might be sick.
Well, Floyd's a smart cat. Yeah. When you're making $120 million on a fight, you're doing something right there. I mean, that's smart business. And you look at De La Hoya. I mean, the guy made almost $1 billion last year.
It's pretty crazy.
What are these fighters doing different than us MMA fighters are doing?
Yeah.
Maybe I think we're kind of being they're being businessmen, and it's us fighters are just being fighters. Or excuse me, those fighters just being fighters. I'm being a businessman. I understand this as that.
Some people, though, can't do that with their personality. Their personality lends itself to competing, and that's about it. They like to be stone-faced and stoic, Fedor-like, let their work do the talking for them. But for folks that don't understand, like, if you want to be, if you want to get paid attention to, look, when I go to the expos and, you know, when you're signing, I know that your fucking lines are longer than anybody's, man.
I'm signing for 8 hours.
Yeah, they're ridiculous. Those lines are ridiculous. I've watched that, man. And there's a certain amount of, you know, entertainment to it. There's a showbiz aspect to it that people have to appreciate.
I mean, I'm two different people, man. I think, you know, I think maybe it was because when I was a kid, I always wanted to be that person who had the money. I wanted to be that kid who was accepted in society, I think.
Right. You wanted to feel normal, right?
I wanted to feel normal. And I was always dying for that normalcy. And I never had it. And
that's the drive, right?
Yeah, and that was the drive. And that's what I looked at now. And it was just all the fighters that come up now. Guys, please, if you're listening, please. And I can't explain this enough to you guys. This is a business. No more than that. You come in and you bust your ass. And in 15 years, if you last that long, you'll have a business in front of you that you'll be able to. I made a clothing company. I made a nutrition line, Punishment Nutrition. I was able to build a gym. I was able to not just that, but make my name a brand. I was thankful for Lorenzo Fertitta, Frank Fertitta, Dana White, for giving me the opportunities that I've had through my career to expose the way I have of myself. But the only way for that to happen was to have a good head on my shoulders, to never step on anybody to get ahead. And I think, you know, God overlooks us. You know, like I say, I'm not going to go to church. I don't believe, oh, worship God. You're the best person in the world because of that. No. Have open hands and help people around you and be respectful. Don't step on people to get ahead. And I really think good things will happen. And my whole career, I look at it, you know, I could have made a left or I could have made a right. And I went the right way. And I'm thankful because of it, you know, because I had three choices in life: dead or in prison or where I am right now. And I'm pretty damn thankful to be where I am right now.
I'm not a religious person, but I recognize that when a person becomes religious or when a person adopts the ideals of religion, of wanting to do the right thing, like the really simple ideals, wanting to do the right thing, treat your brothers as if they were yourself, to go through life with that idea that you are aspiring to the wants and desires of a higher power that's all-knowing, like, you're going to do better. It's like, yeah, it's really simple. I mean, it's not whether or not you're believing in fairy tales. It's the idea that you're aspiring to a higher connection with your brothers and sisters on this planet, with the universe itself. And if you can call that God, you can call that anything you want, whatever. Man. Call that anything you want. It makes
I have that battle all the time with people. People are like, oh, you don't believe in Jesus. I was like, but some guy who someone talked about?
It's
like,
yeah, maybe. Who knows? Maybe you don't know either, bitch.
They don't know.
They don't know. You don't know. If you were born in 1972, you do not know about Jesus.
Prove that shit. You know, all I got to say is, you know, before I go to bed at night and I brush my teeth and I look who's around me, it's myself. I look in the mirror and I said, did you do something today to help somebody? Most of the days, yes. Some of the days, no. Am I going to do something tomorrow to help somebody?
Yeah.
I'm going to try. And every day I do that, I believe in myself of saying, you're going to be a better person by doing that. I don't need to answer somebody else. I ain't got to go, God, please help me. Because, I mean, don't get me wrong, there's been times that I've been challenged. I say, why are you doing this to me right now? You know, there's been times where I'm just like, go on, man. The challenges I've been through, my relationships, you know, personal stuff. You know, why is my parents treating me like this? Why? And all I kept... The question that comes to my mind is, I'm challenging you. What type of man are you? What type of character do you have that you could prevail through this?
With every moment of adversity in your life comes an opportunity to grow and learn.
100%. And every time I've had, I mean, 2 years ago, I mean, I went through the worst stuff I've ever had in my life. And just to kind of correct my character, it was a factor that it was a challenge. You know, it was a true challenge that I look back on. I was just like, that's what you get for trying to help somebody. And I looked and I realized that, you know, I made myself better. I made myself mentally stronger because I went through the things I did.
Well, I don't know what you're referring to, that you went through some personal thing.
Yeah,
thing. Yeah, I mean, it's just a part of life. It's like what I said about, it's weird that all the interesting people I know all have fucked childhoods. Yeah. It's like adversity can really make you a more interesting, introspective, more well-rounded person. It really, if you allow it to. Or
if you allow
you can just decide that, oh, life hates me.
Life hates me. Yeah. God's not doing anything for me, so I'm just going to quit. I mean, stop being a fucking pussy and step up and be a man.
Exactly. That sounds like a meathead thing to say, but that is reality.
That's true.
It's reality. Don't be a fucking pussy.
Don't be a pussy. And step up and be a man. Step up and make the right choices. Make the right choice for yourself. Don't do it because someone else told you. Don't do it because you're doing it to show someone wrong. No, do it because you look in the mirror and you're by yourself and you say, are you going to do something better today?
Is this an attitude and is this a philosophy that you've sort of developed through trial and error through your life?
100%.
When you sort of slowly patched it together and pieced it together?
100%. And I think it all comes down to my children. I want to make sure I'm a good dad.
So you feel like just having these children, having these kids that look up to you, makes you an even better person, makes you aspire to a higher calling.
Yeah, I think so. It really started was when I was an assistant coach at Marina High School in Huntington Beach, working with the kids and watching them going, coach, 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 coach. And it wasn't the fact of just showing them how to work hard. I would help them with their relationships. They would ask me, like, this girl's giving me problems, and they're done.
So you felt like you could provide a service that you didn't get when you were a kid?
100%. Because I went through those same type of trials when I was a kid. I always wondered why. And I was always the kid asking the questions, why? Yeah. I always was challenged by that. And I think through my life, I've lived through what people have gone through and have quit and have never made it past. And I've made it past because I believe that I was able to do it. I mean, there were times, I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, I'd ask for people for advice. I mean, I would ask for strength. You know, I'd say, God, please help me through this right now. And like I said, I don't go to church, but someone has to believe it was something a little bit bigger to answer to.
When you were a kid when you were a kid and you were an athlete, when you were coming up, was there anyone who you looked up to, anyone who you drew inspiration from, that you looked at their work ethic, like was a Dan Gable type character?
I watched Hulk Hogan and Muhammad Ali.
Hulk Hogan and Muhammad Ali. Oh, yeah, that's brother. A good goddamn combination.
The 24-inch pythons right here.
Oh, yeah. I remember Howard Cosell said something to Muhammad Ali, and Muhammad Ali was irritated at him. And he goes, you're being very truculent, champ. And he goes, well, whatever truculent means, if it's good, I'm that.
I would watch that. I mean, this sport, MMA, it's so new. I mean, there's so much stuff that people haven't touched, even a mark on. Why can't I do the things that Ali did in boxing, in MMA? That's my question I always ask myself. Why can't I do what Hulk Hogan did in professional wrestling?
As far as showmanship.
Showmanship, champion style. I mean, I won world titles. I defended world titles. I made this, or excuse me, I'll retract that. I helped make this sport what it is today. I pushed it to the next level. Maybe I said some shit I shouldn't have said.
Do you have any regrets? If you look back?
I have any regrets? One, and I just think it's just something that I learned, and I think it was the only way I knew at the time was the shit that I said towards Dana. I'm a human, man. I make mistakes, and I was just defending for my family. That's it, man. It's business. It was nothing personal towards him. It was nothing personal, and it was never towards the Fertitta family. I love them. I'm very thankful for everything they've been given to me and gave to me. What I have, if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't have anything I have right now. And Dana was my manager, and he taught me to fight for things. I remember when I fought for pay-per-view. I fought for those things because he told me to fight for those things. He's like, Bosker's doing it. Why can't you do it? We're going to get this from Bob Meyerowitz. We're going to do this. If he's not going to do it, we'll walk away. We'll go to Pride. I looked at him like, I don't want to go fight Japan. I want to stay here in the States. He's like, don't worry about it. They'll answer. So we sat for a week and a half.
Is it weird watching Dana go from being a manager to a promoter?
Different person.
Complete opposite role.
He's different man. Total different. He's not the same person. He's that's not Dana. All right. I love him. I miss his friendship. And, I mean, me and him were boys. And I see him change. And he's become famous. It's crazy. 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 I can't say nothing bad about him because he's given so much to me. I've said everything that I wanted to through my career. And it was nothing ever personal towards him. It was always business. And it was no more than that. I was defending for my family. I was defending for... as a business, Tito Ortiz brand, punishment brand, was a business to me. And I wasn't going to get walked around. I wasn't getting walked over on.
I
was
taken advantage. I don't know the specifics of your dispute.
How much time we got? Things. Let's talk about it. I'm joking.
But I've known Dana from the beginning when they first bought the organization. He's definitely different. You know, yeah. He's more confident now. He's more successful now. But me and we have a very different relationship.
When I was growing up, they call that cockiness. But now you said confidence, so I guess I'm
well,
right.
Well, you know, it's also that hubris is how he gets things done. Yeah, I mean, that's why he's so good at what he does.
Yeah, no, he does an awesome job at UFC. I mean, if it wasn't for him, we wouldn't be where we are today, that's for sure.
He's got a whole lot of doesn't give a fuck. I appreciate that.
Yeah, no,
fucking I appreciate how much the guy works for it. Yeah. And I also appreciate, I like watching people grow. I like watching a guy who's not, you can call it cocky, but my relationship with a dude's very different than yours. I've never really had a dispute with him. Me and him we're cool now.
We talk, but I can still see.
I think you have to have an unflappable belief in yourself to run a company like that.
Yeah,
and you could say that's negative all you want, but I think in order to do what he does, you got to be like that. I think he's the perfect guy for the job.
It's a business.
Yeah. I think along with you, he's one of the more integral reasons why this sport has become what it's become. It's you got to have someone who's nuts running the fucking thing. Yeah. You know, it's a crazy sport, man. This ain't a normal sport.
No.
You know, it's nuts.
I think it should be about the fighters a little more, but that's just my opinion.
Well, it is an opportunity, and it's an opportunity that you have capitalized on better than most, and that opportunity to really, like you said, make a brand, make a name for yourself,
and fighters. I mean, I can't explain this to fighters more enough. Is do something different that the other fighters are doing. As when I first started it, I was the first guy to make fighter cards. All of a sudden, Rampage started doing it. I mean, I helped Rampage do it, but
when you say fighter cards, is like cards with
the little.
Like, so you can stats hand them out and everything.
Yeah, yeah. Right. I make 10,000 of those. I'm at my 16th edition of doing them. I just didn't. I have one more. I'm doing my last one, my retirement, or my last one. But I made 10,000 of each one, and wherever I would go, I'd pass them out. I would literally sit there and put them on every single chair in the front row.
That's funny.
And it was branding. I understood by doing that. I mean, there was a part, I think it was 5 years ago, where I got a letter from UFC saying, "You can't do that anymore, Tito." I was like, "What do you mean I can't do it anymore?" He goes, "You can't do that anymore. It's free." I was like, "But you can't do that anymore. You can't promote yourself." I was like, "Okay, I'll keep my mouth shut then." That was just...
They said you couldn't put cards on chairs?
Nope.
What's up with that?
Because people don't want to sweep up. A lot of people are throwing those cards away.
I mean, there's popcorn on the floor.
Come on, Joe.
Yo, why do you need to put more paper on the ground, Brian?
People are supposed to put them in their pocket.
Listen, that's what happens when a business becomes big. They all sudden start developing corporate rules.
It's good. But I say, I mean, as fighters, I want to be an inspiration to fighters, man. And you guys got to promote yourself. I mean, UFC will do their part, yes.
Do you think that's a big part of your legacy? Like, that's one definite thing that you added to the game.
Yeah. Promotion. It was about promotion. It was Hulk Hogan, dude.
Yeah.
I followed his footsteps.
Well, you were the only guy who was doing it, really. There was no one who was doing it you were doing it.
Dan Henderson started making fighter cards. Randy Couture started making fighter cards. I was making them for him. I was getting them done for him.
That's
and
funny.
They understand it. But it was about Liddell had fighter cards. I have fighter cards of me and Chuck Liddell. I'm Chuck Liddell's fighter cards. And there's fans that came up to me and showed me them. And you see a little Team Punishment logo on them.
That's funny.
That was funny because I was back with me and Chuck Liddell. We're never friends.
It's got to be a strange thing for you to have watched going from where you did that first fight in 1997 to seeing Roger Huerta on the cover of Sports Illustrated and seeing all this.
It's cool, dude. It's cool.
What is it like to watch this all? Like, I mean, you literally got on the train at the first stop.
This last month has been really heart-wrenching for me. It's just one of those things just going, wow. I've helped get this where it is today.
And it's over.
But I'm okay with it. I'm cool with it.
I'm good with it. You seem like you're happy with it.
I'm really, really happy. And there's people come up to me and like, "So when you coming back, when you fight?" I'm like, "I'm done." And it was funny. I was sitting with my therapist and he's like, "So fighters," I mean, we just kind of met a couple months ago, but he's like, "So fighters, I mean, I know boxers after they fight, they want to come back and do it." I go, "No, dude, I'm done. I'm done. I made my money. My kids are their future is just done. They can go to college, they go to any university they want, they can get their master's. I'm done. I've done what I wanted to do. My clothing company is doing awesome. My nutrition, my punishment nutrition is doing awesome. You know, my gym's starting to grow. I'm gonna start trying to do some acting. I think I use my brain for a lot more than just fighting. and I'm sick of all the pressure. I'm sick of being expected so much of. I've been doing 15 fucking
When you say the pressure, you mean the psychological pressure of performing, yes. of getting in there and, yes. and throwing, knowing you're going to get hurt, knowing you're going to get fucked
not
up.
Knowing you're going to get hurt, knowing that you got to not letting my fans down, not letting my family down, not letting my kids down, not letting so many people around me down, you know. And people always think about, well, you shouldn't think about losing. I don't think about losing. Not the fact of losing. That goes through my mind. Of course, that's just maybe 5% of the thought. No, it's thinking about, well, what if I get bounced on my head again and I'm paralyzed? I had that happen once before I fought Forrest, UFC 106. I got bounced on my head by Aaron Rosa, and my arms and legs were completely numb for 2 minutes. I was laying in the middle of the cage up in Big Bear for 2 minutes paralyzed. That's some Whoa. Scary shit. I mean, people don't understand that. People don't see that. People don't understand that. My training partners want to see that. My trainers see that shit. The fans don't see that. They think, oh.
How did you deal with that?
Well, 2 minutes later, I got up. The emergency or the paramedics came. I got up and said, we're taking your emergency. I'm like, no, I'm cool. I'm good. I'm good. Test my arms. I'm good. I'm okay. Went laid in bed for a couple days. Woke up that next day, and I just had pains going on my arms, so I went and got injections. I got cortisone injections in my neck. They gave me 15 shots.
So this is the same neck injury that you wound up getting surgery on?
Yeah, I got surgery.
That's where it started?
This was 3 weeks before UFC 106. This is when I found out that Brock Lesnar pulled out, and I became the main event. So I wasn't pulling out. I had to pay for my family, of course, but at the same time, I didn't want to lay Dana down. Because if I would have pulled out, he goes, oh, here's Tito again, fucking pulling out a match. He's going to go blast me on fucking the internet, blast me on media, saying Tito's being a pussy again. And that's the only thought that's ever came about my fans of having that question is because of him blasting me. And it sucks, man. I just wish it never came about that part. But I look at it, I had to get a surgery. I thought it would go away after I got my injections. It felt better. In the third round of that fight, when I fought Forrest the second time, I remember third round going, fuck. I ain't got nothing left. Don't get knocked down. Don't get taken down. You got the match won. They ended up giving him the match. And I remember after going, God, thank God this is over. I had a fracture. My eyebrow bone was cracked. I was pretty beat up after that fight. And I remember 3 weeks before, a month and a half before that fight even happened, Dana asked me if I'd do the Ultimate Fighter. I said, of course I'll do it. No problem at all. And this situation came about. It was already signed for me to do it. And I thought if I took a month off, I came back and shot it in January, that I'd be okay. I can get through the camp, and then I would fight Chuck. Was sparring with the guys I was training with for the Ultimate Fighter, and I got hit with a couple shots. And between training, I went home to watch TV, laid down, went to go get up, and I couldn't stand up. I was like, what the fuck? I started to feel the same pain. I had sickness in my stomach. I was dry heaving. I went to the doctors, and they said, you got a ruptured disc in C6, C7. I told Dane, I called and told him, and he was like, oh, okay, sure. I was like, what do you mean, okay, sure? Well, dude, they got a ruptured disc in my neck. He's like, all right, well, we got to have the UFC doctors to make sure. I go, all right, so, okay, question me. They showed ruptured disc. They went in, did surgery. 5 days before the Ultimate Fighter season 11 was over, he goes, we got to let you go. I go, what do you mean we got to let me go? You go, you're not going to be fighting, so we need to promote the next fight. I go, so you're going to fucking fire me on television? He goes, yeah, that's the way it's supposed to be. He goes, I would do that with anyone. I go, dude, that's fucking, are you serious right now? He goes, yeah.
The show, though, is to promote a fight, right? That was the idea.
Then here's a question for you.
Maybe they should work with you.
Yes.
Would you be happier?
I would have been way happier.
When Rich came in, you trained along with him?
100%. Instead of making a limelight of sitting Chuck down and fucking saying that Tito's playing a fight and Chuck getting up, oh, I told you he'd pull out. He's a fucking pussy. He'd pull out. Come on, dude. Be real, man. Are you fucking serious? And that really pissed me off. That was just over the board of doing that. Just to destroy my image. And that's what they've always tried to do. And I took it to heart. I'm being real, dude. I don't give a fuck what people say. When they came about and Dana says that I came out and I was one of the only UFC fighters that destroyed the company, bullshit. I've never been that. I've always tried to help this company prevail and get better, and he's the only type of guy that's ever tried to destroy me. And thank God to my fans, and thank God I could fucking fight well. Thank God I've always spoke my mind. The fans have supported me, that I was able to become who I am. And the only reason that happened was because I worked hard to get where I am. And I look at the situation that I've been portrayed over the last 8 years. It's been bad, but I've been able to survive. And you look at other fighters like Matt Lindland. He was a champ. People forget about him because he tried to stand up. There's other fighters that try to do the same thing and stand up. They're forgot about.
Well, in the defense of the UFC, Matt Lindland wore a shirt that was forbidden. It was a casino shirt. He wore it to a casino, right? Isn't that what happened at a weigh-ins? That's why they banned him?
I don't know.
You know, I don't know. Well, I don't want to speak to the specifics of his details.
Well, you're in the same situation as Rico Rodriguez, and he had fucking power or a station on his back, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Rico stayed around. But just to kind of go back on where the conversation about The Ultimate Fighter, now with Dominic Cruz and
Uriah Faber.
Mm-hmm. Why didn't Dominic Cruz go home?
Well, he hurt himself on the show.
Okay. Why didn't he go home?
Well, I think it was late in the season, wasn't it?
Yeah, but mine was 5 days left.
I don't know, man. You have to tell me. I'm just looking at real.
Yeah, no, I'm just looking at some issues. Yeah, but I'm just looking at the real questions that you know the things that.
I think it's unfair to bring this up unless he was here as well. I don't know all the details of it. Yeah, just, I'm sorry that it happened with you.
Yeah, it's just things that I always think about. I think my fans are really bummed about. And yeah, they have those same questions.
So too. You feel like you just unfairly portrayed as far as like your injuries, and they try to make fun of your character.
100%, 100%, and it was to downplay me. And you know, like I said, man, that's behind me now. But those still things that I still hear all the time from my fans, and I still hear. For my family, and it hurts my feelings. And when my kids start talking about it, and they get made in front of school for things like that, that's my kids, man. And it's just challenging.
Well, what do kids say to your kid?
Pick on my kid. Just saying, oh, your dad's a pussy. Yeah, like gnarly stuff. Dude, kids.
That's hilarious. And it's hilarious that kids would actually have the balls to say that a former light heavyweight champion of the UFC is somehow a pussy.
But the raddest thing is the only association they get that from is from Dana. Because my dad, my kids all, he's a champion. What are you talking about? How can you say that? He's all, that's what Dana White says. And it's like, this is 10-year-old kids, man.
They're just always trying to talk shit.
Take their names down, go to the school, and just give them a wink.
Yeah, no. No, the raddest thing is it's a private school. And I went and talked for career day at my school. And I kind of told her my story about me coming up and everything. And how my real name's Jacob. Of course, all listeners, you don't know my true name. Not my true name's Tito, but my real name's Jacob, my birth name.
And you have a true and a real name? Well, I only have a real name.
I have a fake name.
What's your fake name?
What's your stage name?
Burbank Bad Boy Brian Redband.
Yeah! That's a quadruple B right there.
That's a Burbank Bad Boy.
Yeah.
I water the lawn after seven, before seven.
You don't give a fuck, right?
Yeah, don't give a fuck.
Dude, no, you're breaking all kinds of town ordinances and shit.
But like I say, my name's Jacob, and in the Bible... Jacob wrestled against an angel, and Jacob lost to the angel, and the angel saved his life. Well, wrestling saved his life. Wrestling saved my life. My son's name is Jacob. He loves wrestling now. He just took second in the state just this year at 10 years old.
That's pretty awesome.
I know. It's really awesome.
I don't know what has to do with some other dude named Jacob that was born a billion years ago.
Yeah.
Or not.
He wrestled against an angel.
Did he really, though?
Yes. In the Bible, read.
Yeah. I don't think it happened. Yeah. You really think he wrestled an angel?
Of course he did.
He was probably sleeping. Nah, he had a crazy fucking dream, and he told some people about it. He
probably ate some mushrooms and like smoking some weed, right?
He's like, dude, I was wrestling a dude with wings. It was really fucked up because
I just remember that story.
He was pinning me down with the wings.
And it just I associate it. I mean, like I say, I'm not really a Bible thumping person, but that story just hit me right at home because wrestling saved my life. And I made a shirt, actually. People go to punishment.com. It says wrestling saved lives. And wrestling
I've seen that shirt. I've seen a lot of people wearing it lately. That's one of the cool things about Punishment Athletics. You sponsor many fighters.
Yeah, I sponsor a lot of fighters.
A lot of fighters wearing your shirts.
Yeah, I try to give an opportunity. You know, they can make a piece of the shirts that we make personally for them. We give them a big chunk so they could help promote. And that's what it comes down to. I want to show guys as business-wise to promote what you got to do it. People say, I'm just going to wear a shirt and I'm going to sell a bunch. No, you got to get on Twitter. You got to follow. You got to post pictures about it. You got to make the interest for the social media for people to understand you, who you truly are. And I think that's what it really comes down to, that I've helped.
Now, you talked about counseling, that you've gone through counseling. Did you do any while you're fighting? Did you do any sports psychology work? Nothing?
No.
No?
I tried it when when I got married with my ex, Kristen. We were going through relationship counseling, and I started to get soft, I think, because I started realizing why I was reacting the way I was.
You started to get soft?
I think it was just myself. I started getting to my feeling touch, you know, my
You thought it was going to fuck you up as a fighter?
Yeah, I thought it was. I stopped.
That's hilarious. You know, I took yoga when I was young, and I stopped taking it because I thought if you were enlightened, it would be bad for you as a comedian.
Yeah,
that's crazy. You wouldn't be as funny, because a lot of my fucking comedy was like being mean about people.
Hey, comedy's fucking funny, dude. Let me tell you, man. Dude. I've never laughed so fucking hard in my life. That shit is funny.
Oh, thank
funny,
you.
Funny, funny, funny.
I know that thing. Like, you know, for me, my childhood was not nearly as hard as yours, but I had a bad dad. My parents divorced when I was 5, and my mom remarried my stepdad, who was a great guy. So from 7 on, my childhood was pretty goddamn good. You know, everybody's nice, nobody beat me up, but my father was a terrible person, and I have these crazy memories of my dad beating up my mom, and I didn't realize until I was a grown man that was why I was angry all the time. I really didn't realize that, you know, a person looks at their father, a child, especially a boy, you look to, this is the person who's already done it. This is my goal. You know, I want to be like him. This is my superhero.
Yeah, yeah,
when you see a terrible person in place of that, and you just feel like the world fucked you with a shitty deck of cards.
You want to repay the world back by being that same fucking person.
Somehow or another.
You know, I'm very thankful that my dad was actually good till I was about 6. Because I remember the loving feeling of my father, but then the absentness after I was 6 of my mother and my father. I'm talking to my therapist, and that's why I'm always looking for a mother figure around me. I know my girlfriend, Kristen. I mean, I started dating her after my second year out of my first year out of high school, and I was with her the whole time. You know, I mean, it was just me and her, and I was always looking for that mother figure. You know, me and Jenna together, she's perfect for me. I mean, me and her have the same associations in life coming up, business-wise. We're never supposed to be successful. We didn't have loving parents and da-da-da. But we still are missing that same type of role models in our life. You know, her mother died at the age of 3. Her father's never around. So I think we just kind of work hard to be the best parents that we possibly can be. And I think working on each other and making that happen is what it comes down to, I think, you know, learning from it.
Well, you know, also learning from, how about you talking about it, man? You know, this shit wasn't available when your parents were coming up, nor when my parents were coming up. We didn't have anybody sitting around talking real about relationships or real about being raised by cunts.
Dude, seriously, I mean, and, you know, any people who are parents now who had fucked up parents, make a difference.
Yeah.
Don't keep that cycle going. Fuck the cycle, man.
Fuck the cycle.
Fuck.
Doesn't have to keep
going. No.
You can grow and learn.
Grow and learn and read.
And move on. Yeah.
Read.
Yeah.
Find someone else who has a great family and try to be something like that.
Well, this conversation alone, I'm sure. Look, this podcast gets heard by a lot of people over the world. I guarantee you it's going to speak to a lot of people.
I hope so. You know, and like I said, I can't rehearse this over and over and over and over again. Is be truthful to yourself. And don't step on people to get ahead. And I'm telling you, good things happen for that. Good things happen.
And you got to embrace the losses. You got to embrace the losses that life hands you, because you're not perfect. No one is. You're not born perfect. You got to embrace the losses as far as relationships. You got to embrace them in your social life as well as embrace them in your business life. You got to learn. And the only way to learn is to try and fail. That's the only way.
No, that's the only way to do it, man.
Just keep getting up. Keep moving forward. Learn. Grow. Continue to analyze yourself. Right?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a learning process. I mean, like I say, every day, test yourself.
What's beautiful in this day and age, what's beautiful in this era of endless information is that kids are listening right now, people who you can influence, and I guarantee you they're going to get something out of this.
Yeah,
I guarantee you.
Even parents,
they're going to get
a
direction.
Parents,
even parents, old people, man. No one's too old to learn and grow.
Tell you, when I did The Apprentice, I had a whole different demographic when I did that show. I was like, holy shit. We walk in the airport, and there's like 80-year-old old ladies come up to me going, "Hi, Tito, how are you?" "I watched you on Apprentice, and you're such a nice guy. I started watching The Ultimate Fighter, and you're a different person." "Why?" That's my fight game. He's like, "But you're still a really nice guy."
Thank you very much. Who were you on The Celebrity Apprentice with?
Lennox Lewis, who won it that year. Pierce Morgan won it that year.
Lennox Lewis, what was he like?
He's a cool cat.
He's a bad motherfucker.
Yeah, he's a bad motherfucker. He's laid back, cool.
What a nice guy.
I went out partying a couple times.
Really?
He's a cool dude. Really, 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 really cool guy. You know,
chess playing, bad motherfucker.
He's calm, yeah. Collective. He's just like cool.
Yeah.
He's just a cool black folk. Just like, he's cool, man. He's
you know
cool
what
cat.
I really loved about Lennox Lewis, man, is that he had some fucking bad losses. Like, Haseem Rahman knocked him out. Yeah. Like, he got, and he came back.
He come back.
Yeah, I mean, he was a real human dude. He wasn't like, when Tyson was the king, it was like, it was Tyson the Destroyer, and then it all fell apart. But with Lennox Lewis, is like, you know, like he stumbled and got back
got
up.
Back
stumbled.
Up.
Vladimir Klitschko was another one. Yeah. Got stopped a bunch of times. Corey Sanders knocked him out. You know, it looked like he was losing it. It looked like Vladimir was never going to be the dominant guy that he is today.
Yeah.
I love even an Overeem story. I love a guy who moves forward. There's Tito in The Celebrity Apprentice. What is that like?
It was a lot of work, man. That was me walking out. And let me tell you, after 8 straight weeks, I was like, thank God I'm going home right now. Because I had an opportunity to sell out and step over Omarosa and call her out and just make her look like shit. And I didn't. I was straight up dude. You know, I think Trump seen that. Trump goes, "You know what, Tito? You're an awesome guy. You got some great things ahead of you."
You didn't call out Omarosa?
Yeah.
If you wanted to serve the public, you should call her out.
Yeah, you just choked her out.
We had her on Fear Factor. That bitch is crazy.
She's a cool...
you were on with Stephen Baldwin?
Stephen Baldwin.
Oh,
she's actually a cool lady, dude. She actually was a cool lady, but when the cameras came on, was...
Yeah, she's hustling.
Yeah, she's hustling for sure.
Did Steve Baldwin try to sell you on Jesus?
For about a half a second. But not really. No, he's a cool dude. And then he realized that I was with Jenna, and he was like, "Oh, okay."
Who is that pretty girl? The blonde.
Oh, that's
is that his daughter?
That's his daughter. Yeah,
Trump's daughter?
Yeah, she's a really cool girl. Really, really nice girl.
She seems really cool. That'd be a great person to date. Trump's daughter.
Yeah, no, she's married now.
And who are all the other people in that? Who's that?
She's a model, supermodel. That was some guy from...
Pierce Morgan was on the show?
Pierce Morgan won it. He wanted that.
Did he really?
Yeah, no. He was a cool cat.
Is he a cool guy?
Yeah, he's a pretty cool cat. He's smart. He's a very, very crafty dude, for sure.
Yeah, he's like the anti-Larry King. It's like really is paying attention.
Yeah, no. Yeah,
he's asking questions, really paying attention.
No, he's a smart guy, dude. I'm serious. Yeah. He's crafty. He has some great ideas. As were when he was project manager or whatever, but... he was a really good dude. He has some good connections. He has some really great donations. But to me, being on that show was put a light on MMA, of course, but for charity. You know, my charity was St. Jude's Children's Hospital. I raised over, I think it was $90,000 just from the show. But then $100,000 were donated to St. Jude's Children's Hospital under my name. So, I mean, raising that much money for St. Jude's, that was my biggest thing. Help kids, man. I want to help.
That's awesome, man. That's awesome. I think this podcast is going to help a lot of people, man. I think.
And, you know, people understand, you know, where I come from, you know. And I think people get so associated automatically with the ultimate fighting. It's so easy to point.
Fuck this guy.
Yeah.
This guy sucks.
Yeah, this guy sucks.
Fuck this guy.
This guy's a pussy. This guy sucks.
It's so easy for people to do that.
People don't understand until they get in the cage and they fight. When they get in the gym and they lift weights, they're like, "Oh, I'm sore right now." Yeah. Man.
You don't even know what sore is, bitch.
You don't even know what sore is. Oh, I ran 3 miles today. I'm sore. You don't even know what sore is.
Well, not only you came along in a time where the ultimate, you know, fighter didn't exist, or, you know, the ultimate fighting in MMA was in its, like, really its infancy when you came along, but you also came along in an age where the internet was at its infancy.
Yes.
So it was the first time where athletes could get shit on every day by a million YouTube people and Twitter people.
That's another thing too. Like I said, the fighters who are listening, don't listen to fans. Don't listen to them. We tell you, man, because it got to me. I got to a point where I was like, you know what? And I block people like no other. No, the negative stuff. Since the Bader fight, I have no more negative stuff. I don't battle back and forth people. I don't call people out. I don't say shit.
It's not worth it.
I just block them.
Yeah.
No reading. Let's just block them. Fuck the negative. All about positive, baby. That's what I'm talking about. And I've lived my life since like that. And life has been so much better because when you involve yourself into a positive environment, it just spawns more positivity. And it sounds, you know, kind of
hippie. But it's true.
It's true.
Yeah.
It is. If you involve yourself enough in negative energy, negative is going to come about you. And everything around you, you're going to see it goes, God, man, this stuff won't stop. Leave me alone. It's like, stop dwelling on it.
Yeah.
You know, and it was right before the Bader fight. It was funny because everyone was just talking shit and just, you're done and da da da. And I just, you know what? I'm believing in myself. I remember just thinking to myself, I'm going to believe myself.
And no more fans. Can't talk.
I can't
listen to them.
I just said, you know what? I watched this Bader fight. I remember doing an interview with one of the guys. So what are you going to do after this fight since your career is going to be done? I looked at him. I go, when I win, you'll see. I go, what? I go, watch. When I win, you'll see. It was actually Showdown Joe from Canada. I go, when I win, you'll see. And no one understood it. I go, just watch. Watch when I win.
How annoying is it talking to reporters that are telling you you're going to lose?
Ignorance is bliss.
It's so stupid. First of all, like people always say, you know, what's going to happen in this fight? I always say, I don't know. That's why they got to fight.
The
only reason to watch is because you don't know.
Yeah, you don't know.
You don't know what the fuck is going to happen.
And that's one thing about UFC, and I think that's why Dana and Joseph do such a great job. It's not like boxing. Fighters aren't built. You won't see a UFC guy built. No way. Boxers are built to be 28-0.
When you say built for the uninitiated, what you are saying is set up with easy fights.
Set up with easy fights.
Until
they're slowly tested, and then they're 28-0, and they're built to become world champions. And they're built in their
last... Or at least to have a good financial run at the title.
Yes.
A highly respected, well-ranked contender.
Exactly, and it's smart. That's smart business. There's two situations. You can have a WWE or you can have a professional wrestling.
Right.
Or, excuse me, a professional boxing. As in WWE, they're washing guys in and out so fast that you don't really get a chance to
catch on. Well, it's not real, though. It's not fighting.
But still, it's making money.
Uh-huh. Okay, I see what you're saying.
Okay, so they're having guys that are getting put in every single week of all different guys. So you're not building one single person. Now, as in boxing... How you have guys like De La Hoya, guys have like Ali, and they were built coming up. You know, De La Hoya had some easy fights his first 6, 7, 8 fights, 10 fights, 15 fights. Then all of a sudden, when he's 20-0, then now he starts fighting guys who, at the tail end of their career, now he's knocking guys out. And holy shit.
Well, also, I think you have to take into account that boxing has been around for so long, they really have their situation down as far as like how to develop a fighter correctly.
Yeah.
If you wanted to look at it from the point of view of the fighter, that's the way to do it. I mean, the way to do it is to be tested slowly where, you know, or, you know, there's this fucking John Jones type dudes that just jump into the deep end of the pool after three years in and dominate.
There's exceptions for guys like that. Guys like John Jones is just a tremendous athlete. That guy, I have respect for that guy like no other. He's amazing. I watched that kid and I'm just like...
Is it weird seeing like the next level coming up? Like seeing the Rory McDonalds?
It's crazy. It's cool. Yeah. It's good to see.
It's wild.
It's cool because you can get the Rory McDonald come up to me and you're like, dude, man, I've been watching you since I've been like 6 years old. I'm like, fuck. I'm really that old.
Mike McDonald, I think he's only 21, maybe. 21. Yeah, maybe 22.
And it's crazy. It's like kids come to my gym at Punishment Training Center in Huntington Beach, and they're 10-year-old kids who do kickboxing, jiu-jitsu, and they're doing MMA classes now. I'm just like, are you joking me? And parents are calling. I was like, yes, do you do UFC at your gym? I'm like, excuse me? Do you do the UFC fighting style at your gym? I'm like, you mean MMA, mixed martial arts? Yes, do you do that? Yes, we do. We're bringing our kid down. It's like, I mean, I teach classes on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and it's crazy, dude. The kids just like,
Tito. You teach kids classes?
Yes, I teach kids classes.
Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, that's badass. And so it's in Huntington Beach? Where at? Where? How can they find it? What is the website?
It's actually punishmenttrainingcenter.com. punishmenttrainingcenter.com.
So that is also one of the fucking cool things about the sport is that you can go and take classes. Your kid can from a former world champion.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
You know, to me, it's just, like I say, I've always wanted to be a coach. I love it. I dig it. I love seeing a kid progress. You know, I remember when I first started at Marina High School, we were last in the league. I was there for 2 years, and when I left, we were second in the league. And just to watch a kid progress and just seeing his attitude and just how they respond to things, and from the negative to the positive, and just being an involvement around them, they're just like, wow, like, it's crazy.
Could you imagine if you were a young boxer?
You see right there.
Oh, beautiful.
And I painted myself.
Oh, that's a nice-ass place, man.
No, I painted myself.
You painted that place?
There's the floor. See the red floor on the left? Well, all the red flooring. I did all the red, and that's carpet on the right. And that's all.
Holy shit, that place is fucking huge. How many square feet is that?
It's actually 10,000 square feet.
If that's what she said, she's talking about her pussy, because I said that place is fucking huge.
No, I thought you said that was huge.
No, I said that place is fucking huge.
I thought
you said
that was huge.
Almost works.
Almost works. It sounded good, though.
That's a massive fucking gym, man.
Yeah, no, but the color itself, it was red, black, and white. I really just put my heart into it, man. What I wanted for training and get the next level of fighters, of course. You know, we do girls kickboxing there also. We do... kids wrestling, kids jiu-jitsu.
And you've only been open for about 2 years now?
No, 1 year.
1 year?
1 year now.
Wow.
And we're still building, man. It's a class that or a school that I've really just tried to give for, you know, the youth.
Look at that. Jiu-jitsu, kids, Muay Thai, adults, kids wrestling. That's fucking awesome, man.
And it's the women come in, they dig it. The women come in, they do kickboxing. It's like all of a sudden the girls now, it's a rad thing. The girls come in and going, I want to do MMA fighting. It's like, you're a girl. I'm like, no, but I want to do MMA fighting. I want to be like Ronda Rousey. It's crazy.
Well, you stuck to Huntington Beach, huh?
Yeah, I ain't going. No, you gotta understand. When I lived in Huntington, from the age of 7 to 13, I moved to Santa Ana. That was my parents had the drug problem. I moved to Santa Ana, and then when I was 13, my mother separated my father, and she got remarried and moved me back to Huntington. And all the time I grew up, all the kids lived in the harbor, Huntington Harbor, and all the rich prissy kids. And I remember fishing on one of the docks back there. And I was like, one day, guys who I was fishing with, my friend Dave Cottle, who's a friend of mine, I go, one day I'm going to buy a house here. He looked at me and goes, shut the fuck up. That's whatever. I go, dude, I'm serious. One day I'm going to buy a house here. Well, we shot this that one Bad Blood DVD with me and Chuck. They shot it. And I told that story. And he was with me on the boat. And... a week prior to that, I took him on my boat to ruin fish. He goes, God, dude, remember that one time that we were sitting on the fucking dock here fishing for bat rays? You told me you're going to get a house here. I never forgot that. And he goes, dude, that is crazy shit. But it's just one of those things. And I'm not leaving Huntington. I live in the harbor. I own a fishing boat. Now my kids are the rich little prissy kids. But he's not the prissy kids. They're the rich little rich kid that, you know. But it's just an opportunity, you know. I'm changing the cycle. And I look at it as I worked hard to get where I am today. You know,
what's so great about Huntington Beach?
No crime.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, crime is very, very, like, I think it was 94 to 97 is the safest world in the United States.
Safest part of the United States?
Safest city in the United States.
Really?
Yes. And the HBPD does an awesome job down there. And the city, the little town I live in, or not town, little... area that I live in, it's really nice. No gangs at all. No gangs there at all. Crime is pretty much nil. There's downtown. Kids get a little crazy. But like I said, HBPD does an amazing job down there just making sure it's very safe.
So to you, it's also like sort of a sentimental thing because that represented the good times in your life when you were younger, and now you're back there.
Yeah, and you know, I have H and a B behind my arms.
I know.
It's the only tattoos I've ever had.
Forever. You had that shit back in the day when I first met you.
When I was 18, I got it. It was the first tattoos I ever got.
Wow. Huntington Beach represent.
Yeah, it's forever. You know, I look at it and I don't forget where I came from. You know, I remember when I first became the world champion and I was in Vegas and I was partying. I was actually at Cheetah's, a strip club, and I seen Diamond Dallas Page there. This one, he was in WWE. And I was like, I want to get in WWE one day. And he's like, let me tell you one thing, son. You're the champion right now, right? And I go, yeah. He goes, I give you one word of advice. No matter how famous you ever get, don't ever forget where you came from. He goes, you'll be more successful. You never forget where you came from. And I always kept, this is 14 years ago.
So because of one conversation with Dallas Diamond Page, you have repped Huntington Beach. Hard since then.
I've repped it no matter what. I just never forgot where I came from. I just always been an idea in my head is no matter how famous you get and how much never no matter how much money you make, don't ever forget where you came from. Because there's guys that'll make millions and they'll bounce and say, fucking, I forget that neighborhood. I don't need that anymore.
That's me. I'm the first out. As soon as I get some money, fuck you.
Yeah,
see ya.
No, but there's, don't get me wrong, there's places that I would say grab your stuff and get the fuck out of there. Because there is some towns, you know, I mean, Detroit, I mean, there's places in Santa Ana. I mean, there's places in this United States that's really hard. And I advise for, as parents, to get your kids out of there as soon as possible. If you get that opportunity, please do.
I like moving, man.
Yeah.
I think it's good. I wish I didn't have so many good friends in L.A. Because I'd like to live in a bunch of different places all over the country.
Let me tell you, when the weather's 7 degrees year-round,
yeah,
there's no crime, there's a beach, and I could drive an hour and a half and go to the snow.
You also drive 5 hours to get to L.A. The fucking Huntington Beach traffic is brutal, isn't it?
No, from 4 until 7, yeah.
Yeah.
But thank God I started driving up here at 3:30 because I missed all of it. You know, it took me an hour. Yeah.
Listen, man, thank you very much for doing this. A lot of fun talking to you.
Yeah, no, it's awesome.
Anything else you want to say to these people before we wrap this bitch up?
No, you know, I really appreciate all my fans through my career. You know, I appreciate you doing what you've done. You know, this is, I think the fans are very appreciative for having me on here. I am, of course, you know, and thank for Lorenzo Fertitta, Dana White, Frank Fertitta for saving the UFC and giving me an opportunity to give my family what I've always wanted. And that's just being a loving father and to give them things that I never had as a kid. And that's love and wealth.
Tito Ortiz, bitches. Congratulations on a fantastic career and good luck in the future.
Oh,
and
sure.
I know whatever energy that you put into becoming a champion, you put into anything else you choose to focus on. You're still a young man, man. You got a crazy opportunity. You got a whole new life now.
Yeah, I got a whole new life, and I'm excited. People say retirement. It's not retirement. I'm just graduating from fighting. I'm going on.
Yeah, but when they retire, they're old men. You're a young dude.
Yeah, I'm still,
with some fucking crazy parts, some bionic parts.
Yeah, no, I got some good stuff coming up. I got some shows I'm doing, working on now with NBC. So
good. Well, keep us posted, man. No, and if you ever needed anything promoted, come on back, man, let me know. We'll blow it up on Twitter, whatever we're going to do.
Before the year's over, for sure, I'm going to do that.
Okay, and Huntington Beach Training Center, Punishment Athletics.
Punishment Training Center.
Punishment Training Center.
Yes, and then Punishment Athletics, of course, my clothing company. Of course, Punishment Nutrition.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you want to get some fucking classes from Tito Ortiz himself.
Yes.
How awesome would that be?
What days are you teaching there?
Tuesday, Thursdays.
Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Yeah, Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Go on down. Check it out, bitches. And thanks to Onnit.com for sponsoring the podcast. Thanks to Alienware MMA, too, because Alienware, we've been using these computers here for a couple months now. They hooked us up with them, and we're supporting them because they support fighters.
Yeah, what's up, Alienware? I need some stuff. Hook Tito Ortiz
up.
Hook
Tito Ortiz up, bitches.
Yes.
But Alienware sponsors a lot of up-and-coming fighters, and so we support them. If you follow them on Twitter, it's Alienware MMA on Twitter. Just show them some love, ladies and gentlemen.
I'm doing this right now. Let's do this.
Let's do it. All right. Thanks to Onnit.com. If you're down with some Alpha Brain, Troom Tech Sport, Troom Tech Immune, New Mood, or Bone Strong, use the code name Rogan and save yourself 10% off. Also, check out the kettlebells we got going on now and battle ropes, all different sorts of sizes and packages for kettlebells, beginners and expert. And for battle ropes, the battle ropes are all completely new. The cheapest shit you're going to find on the internet, the best quality, it's all at onnit.com. That's Onnit. All right, we'll see you freaks on Thursday with the great Tom Rhodes, great, hilarious, awesome, real international comedian and world traveler, and he's going to be here on Thursday. It should be a lot of fucking fun. And
we also have a Death Squad show tomorrow. Joe Rogan, Don Marrera, we got a possible Doug Benson, Brody Stevens, Ian Edwards, Christina Pajitsky, and a possible Tom Segura.
Oh, that's a beautiful lineup. Ian Edwards, if you've never seen him before, is fucking hilarious. And, of course, Don Marrera, all-time great. So we'll see you, Dirty Bitches, on Wednesday. That's even before this.
Yeah.
Next podcast.
Tomorrow, Ice House.
So tomorrow. Yeah, tomorrow at the Ice House. There's some tickets still available. We just announced it today.
Yeah.
Go to icehousecomedy.com and get your tickets, you dirty freaks. And the Ice House Chronicles podcast that we air simultaneously. How revolutionary is this, ladies and gentlemen? We have a fucking podcast that we do while we're doing a comedy show. The green room of stand-up comedians, or stand-up comedy clubs, rather, has always been the most fun for stand-up comedians. It's the place where we fuck around before we go on stage. Everybody's laughing and joking around. And what we decided to do was turn that into a podcast. So it's called the Ice House Chronicles, and it's only available through the Death Squad label on iTunes. So go check that out and support DeathSquad.tv, dirty bitches. All right, we'll see you soon. See you tomorrow. Ice Health Chronicles, available on this Ustream channel, ustream.tv/Joe Rogan. All right.